Good Monday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, coming to you today from Farmville, Virginia, side of the 2016 vice presidential debate and mixed martial arts extravaganza. Not sure if this is going to be on one of the broadcast networks or on pay-per-view by the time we get to the fall. Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms will join us on the program. Tuesday is primary day in the state of Wisconsin. Jen on the ground there in Wisconsin, so we'll talk with her, find out what the atmosphere is like as Wisconsin gets ready to vote. Meanwhile, there are going to be hundreds of thousands of concealed carry holders who will be heading to the polls tomorrow. Record high number of concealed carry holders, I believe, in the state of Wisconsin. We've got similar stories to tell you about from elsewhere around the country. Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report. We told you last week, George Mason University School of Law renaming the law school after the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Peter says the left is losing their collective mind over this. I'm sure the coctopus is a big part of why the left is collectively losing it. Apparently, $30 million donation. There was an anonymous donor said, you know what, rename the law school after Antonin Scalia. I'll give you $20 million to the law school. And one of the Koch brothers, I believe, kicked in $10 million. So it was a $30 million donation to the law school. It to be renamed in honor of Antonin Scalia. Note, by the way, that this is not called the Antonin Scalia, but really the Coctopus School of Law, right? It's not the Koch brothers' name. I suppose that makes it more nefarious. Or one could say it actually, you know, makes it even more generous. Someone's spending that kind of money, and you've got an anonymous donor, and somebody who says, I don't want my name on the building. I want Antonin Scalia's name on the building. But again, we'll talk about it with Peter Roth later in the hour. Valinda Rowe of Illinois Carry. The Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day is coming up on Wednesday of this week in Springfield, Illinois. It is always a big turnout. I hope that this year is no exception. If you can take time off of work, I know a lot of you already scheduled time off of work. You've got this on your calendar, but if you're just hearing about it now, we're going to tell you how you can be a part of the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day. Antonia Okafor with Students for Concealed Carry, the Southwest Regional Director. Today is a National Hug a Newsperson Day, apparently. Antonia said she's sad that she's only joining us via the telephone. Cameron, this was a fail on our part, so I really should have had some in-studio guests today, I suppose, for National Hug a Newsperson Day next year.
Put it in your calendars. Maybe we can extend it to, like, the week.
Maybe so. Maybe we, I don't know. Is it just me or does it seem like there are way too many holidays now? I can't keep track of them.
I thought about this the other day. I mean, other than National Puppy Day, which I thoroughly enjoyed, there is, every day now, there is a National Fill-in-the-Blank Day, without fail. And I'd never heard of, I saw a tweet that I thought it was a joke, Hug a Newsperson Day. I mean, you're really just reaching for things now. Next is what, National Petty Yak Day.
Who comes up with these? I wonder who decides that this is. Is there some sort of government agency?
I think it's like the greeting card cabal who made up Sweetheart Day. They just, you know, there's some group that gets to make up days to make people buy things for others.
Right. We'll just throw it all against the wall. We'll see what sticks. If they're celebrating it 2 or 3 years from now, then we know we've got a nascent industry on our hands. So yeah, there you go. Well, I got to say, the industry's failing here because it wasn't National Send a News Person a Nice Card Day. It was, you know, and it wasn't Give Us Candy. It was hugs. So there's really nothing of intrinsic value. That's just more of an emotional value. So right now, this holiday has not been commercialized yet. Anyway, we'll talk with Antonia about what's going on in the state of Texas. Story there talking about how personal the fight over campus carry is getting, particularly there at the University of Houston. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom coming up in Hour 3. Christian Toto of Hollywood in Toto. Dan Gaynor over at the fine organization Newsbusters this weekend alerted me to a storyline on ABC's Quantico, which I have to say I don't watch. I don't have anything against it. I just haven't seen it. But there was a storyline in which firearms were a privilege to be earned, not a right here. This is a senator who was at the visited the FBI training academy. Senator portrayed by Marsha Cross. And said this was after an attack there against the FBI training academy. Actually, I guess it's not even after the attack is finished. It's while the attack is still going on, but Senator comes and gives a speech. Said, I'd like to acknowledge the brave men and women who defended our campus today. That includes one of our own, Trainee Perales. 330, that's the number of mass shootings in this country in 2015, an average of almost one per day. I'm tired of this, the senator said. And you should be, too. You are being trained to carry a weapon, to respect the power of a gun, to understand that it is a privilege to be earned, not a right given to anyone who take the day. That was the important part of the speech. And then she just kind of stopped, apparently, in the middle of the sentence and moved on to something else. Do you remember, Cameron, a story, I don't know, probably 3 weeks, maybe a month ago, about this group in Hollywood, was the Entertainment EIC, something like that, the Entertainment blah, blah, blah Commission or Committee?
Yes.
That was
we had to look up.
Trying to, this was one of their big pushes, was that they wanted to try to include more more gun control messaging in entertainment. And I think this is the fruit of their labor starting to pay off here. But we'll talk about it with Christian Toto coming up in hour three. Fascinating that, again, it's kind of this ham-handed, right? Here, we interrupt this scripted drama to bring you a gun control PSA. Now, keep in mind as well that, you know, certainly there are no shortage of anti-gun senators there in the Senate. But you know as well as I do, you talk to law enforcement officers around the country, and I don't care if you're talking about at the federal level, state police, local police, maybe when you get up into the level of politically appointed chiefs. But even then, I think you get them away from a microphone and say, okay, off the record. What do you think about the right to keep and bear arms? Is that a right? People have a right to defend themselves? And, you know, I know that there are some law enforcement officers out there who would say no. I know there are a lot more out there who would say, yeah. Why is that even a question? And that's why this kind of rings hollow. First of all, if some politician gave a speech like this to law enforcement officers while a terrorist attack was still taking place, I would like to think that maybe one of them would just, you know, politely say, Senator, now's not the time for your political speechifying. But I guess that would be maybe dramatic in the wrong way. See, again, this is the wonderful thing about Hollywood is that you can create these stories and you can tell them any way that you want because it's just your imagination. So in the mind of the screenwriter, probably this was the perfect time to launch into a spiel about gun control and how the right to keep arms really isn't a right. I mean, like that, what other time would, you know, you want to do this? This is while we're at our emotional peak here. Don't waste the moment. Don't let a crisis go to waste, Senator. So in that sense, maybe, I don't know, it rings true. But, again, the overall narrative rings a little false. But, again, I think we're going to see a lot more of this type of speechifying. Then we will dramatization of, let's say, again, the mom in Indianapolis defending herself and her child. I mean, how many crime dramas do we have on TV these days, Cameron? Was it up to on the networks? Just on the three networks, we like 50 crime dramas?
Whatever number you say, I'm going to agree with. I've literally no idea. Too many.
I think we're to CSI Poughkeepsie now. I think we've pretty much saturated all of the top 50 media markets there with the CSI and the not one of those crime dramas is going to dramatize that story. We saw Gawker tell old people not to own guns because they're frail and feeble. We've got an armed citizen story for you today coming up in hour three, the Hero of the Day story of an elderly individual able to defend themselves with the help of a firearm, save their life. You won't see that shown in Hollywood. But you'll see another, sort of blatantly anti-gun screed awkwardly dropped into the middle of your favorite show. You'll see more of it. Speaking of Hollywood, by the way, I'll have to talk with Christian about this as well. I saw Hateful Eight over the weekend, Cameron.
Why?
The Quentin Tarantino film that Harvey Weinstein said, he was after the murders at Sandy Hook Elementary, said he wasn't going to make any more violent movies, and then this one came out.
What made you want to watch it?
It was there, and we weren't doing anything.
Right.
And I also did, so here's the other thing. I did kind of want to see how violent it was going to be. Given that Harvey Weinstein said, Hollywood can't keep making these violent movies. I'm not going to be making violent movies anymore. In fact, I'm going to make a movie about gun control. And it's going to be called The Senator's Wife, and it's going to star Meryl Streep, and it's going to be awesome. And that movie hasn't been made. I don't even think it's gone into pre-production. But in the meantime, Harvey Weinstein did work with Quentin Tarantino to release Hateful Eight. So I kind of wanted to see how bad it was. I thought, Cameron, maybe Tarantino would have toned it down a little bit. Maybe Harvey Weinstein would have said, listen, I understand, but can we just... Oh, no.
It was worse than you thought.
Oh, no.
Right?
It was... Yeah, it was Quentin Tarantino. It was, I'm not going to give any spoilers or anything, but it was the Western Pulp Fiction. Or maybe even the Western Reservoir Dogs. It wasn't toned down one iota. So bravo, Harvey Weinstein. Just a masterful job of not making a violent movie there. So we'll talk with Christian Toto about it. But as far as the movie goes itself, it was long. By the way, it was really long. We're about an hour in. Again, I'm not going to give any spoilers away. But my wife turned to me and said, so when does it get interesting? And I said, well, it's kind of like more of like a character study, I guess, than, big dramatic plot developments. But it felt like you had watched a movie for 3 hours when you got done watching it. And again, a violent Quentin Tarantino movie. Kurt Russell, I thought, was pretty good at it. And Jennifer Jason Leigh, Cameron, was the craziest she has been since The Breakfast Club. So there you go.
That's crazy.
I can't. Well, because I guess, you'd have to throw in like single white female in there too, right? That was post Breakfast Club.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You're right.
Do you remember that movie?
Wait.
Vaguely?
I'm trying to think. Who was Jennifer Jason Leigh in The Breakfast Club?
She was the one who had her head down.
Wasn't it Ally Sheedy?
Had the dandruff hair. Oh, Ally Sheedy. Oh, you're right. Oh, my gosh. I just confused my Brat Pack with my...
You lose at 80s trivia.
Brat Pack. I know. Oh, jeez. I feel horrible now. Apologies to one or both of the actresses, I suppose. All right. When we come back, Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms. Oh, that's awful. I'm going to have to go back and look at like IMDb. What else have I forgotten? Holy cow. Cameron, was Corey Feldman in... No, I'm thinking of Leonardo DiCaprio. I'm sorry. I always get those two confused too.
Oh, God.
Whew.
Could you see Corey Feldman as an annoying global warming activist?
Actually, yes. That I could see. Could I see Corey Feldman in Titanic or The Wolf of Wall Street? Probably not. But annoying global warming activist, yeah, he'd probably fit into that role pretty easily. All right, stick around. Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms is going to join us right after a quick timeout here on this edition of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.
Speaking with Bill Poole, he is Managing Director, NRA Education and Training Division. Bill, let's talk about the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course. I understand some of it's now available online. Tell us about it.
Yes, John, it's called blended learning. That means that part of the course is online. It's about a 7.5 hour online training section that students can complete in the comforts of their own home on their own schedule. And then once they've completed the online or the e-learning module, then they can contact an NRA certified instructor who will take them to the range and check out their skills, make sure their safe gun handling is at its top, and that their marksmanship skills are just as good as it needs to be.
So this is the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course, which is, Bill, such a great course and such a great thing. You guys have kind of jiggered things up a little bit there to make it easier for people to do, right?
It is easier, but I don't want anybody to think that that means that it's shorter or less comprehensive. It's about 7.5 hours of seat time when you take the e-learning module, and then about another 5 hours of time when you go shooting. But the good news is the shooting portion can be all done in one day, in half a day, and so it's going to meet the needs of our students' schedules much better than we've been able to do in the past.
I love it. So then get the book learning part done, then get out there to the range with an NRA certified instructor and finish it all up. It's a great idea, this blended learning course. So, Bill, how can folks get more information about this? How can they sign up? How do they do it?
First step is go to our webpage. It's onlinetraining.nra.org, and I hope they all do it today.
Why should folks check out the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course?
It is one of the most vibrant, robust e-learning training courses they're ever going to encounter. There's video, there are 3D pictures. You can listen to it. You can read it. I mean, we've used every modality teachers know how to use. It's an excellent course.
Could have said it better myself. Bill Poole, thank you so much, sir.
So Cosmo Magazine at it again. This time they've got a little video feature on watch four boyfriends listen to their girlfriends tell them how they really feel about guns or something like that.
Right.
And oddly enough, Kimberly, not one of the women featured there is really okay with the idea of her boyfriend owning a gun.
Well, and really, where are the women like me in that video? All I saw were women who had an unhealthy fear of firearms, basically because the media has told them that they should. Ironically enough, it was actually an article in Cosmo that resonated in my 20-year-old mind during the early morning hours of my assault. So I had read some story about a woman who used the tactic of befriending her rapist who had kidnapped her. She convinced him that she wasn't going to tell anyone, and she escaped. I tried the same thing after my assault was complete. He left my bedroom to go get a drink of water from my kitchen and then took off through the front door. I had no way of defending myself that morning, but, you know, I have stared in the eyes of pure evil, and I knew that I wouldn't be left defenseless again. So, of course, I choose to learn about concealed carry and train to a point where I'm comfortable using a firearm for protection. I am literally nowhere represented in that video.
Nope. Not at all.
At all.
No. I mean, in fact, you got four variations of the same theme.
Right.
As you said, I am afraid of firearms. One guy even said, you know, look, I keep my firearms locked up. And his girlfriend said, so you don't know how to operate a key when you're drunk? Which to me makes me think, you know, okay, is the concern here his drinking or his gun ownership? You know, there was a lot of stuff that you wish you almost wish you could have been a relationship counselor in that situation, right?
Exactly. Well, and I think by design, they cast males as the only gun owners in that video because honestly, they're easier to villainize because statistically speaking, men are usually the perpetrators of domestic violence or sexual assault, at least more often than women.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. You know, I was thinking about other actors that I could get confused, Cameron. What if Breakfast Club had been made with Craig T. Nelson and not Judd Nelson? Ponder that for a second. Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms is with us on the program right now. How you doing, Jen?
Hey, I'm good. It's Brewers opening day at Miller Park today, so I'm in a good, good mood.
Oh, congratulations. Lynchburg Hillcats don't open up at home until Thursday, and it's supposed to be rainy and about 35 degrees, so I haven't decided. If they're playing ball, I think I'm going to go out there. But Miller Park, you know, they've got the, they can just close it right up, can't they?
Yes, but it's 28 degrees up here, and it's snowing like the bejesus.
Wow.
Yeah.
Play ball.
Yeah. That's why I'm home. And my brats are happy in the brat tub with some PBR, and I'm good.
There you go. All right. So So what's the weather supposed to be like tomorrow, primary day in Wisconsin?
It's going to be cold still. High of 35 tomorrow, overcast. But we are expecting a tremendous turnout. I get to drive my van to the old folks' home and drive people to the polls like usual. I have to clean out my car later today, but we've gotten a lot of people reaching out, making sure that there's a shuttle going to and from the polls, and looks like it's going to be a big day in Wisconsin tomorrow.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, we're getting into the time of year where in a normal election year, a candidate may have things wrapped up. This year, it looks like we're going to go deep into the primary season. And so,
yep.
You know, a lot of these states that don't ever really experience a contested primary, all of a sudden do get to experience one. I know that Wisconsin has in the past, but have you found that the energy level, the excitement level is higher than normal this year?
I have, only because, you know, remember, I'm way up north.
Yeah.
I'm not down in the crazy south with Madison and Milwaukee, so thank goodness, you know, I'm way up here. But I wanted to see how many stickers or signs I saw on my way through town today, and I saw 3 Bernie Sanders bumper stickers and a couple of Cruz yard signs, which was really impressive because usually we don't see a whole heck of a lot of anything around here, and then 2 for Trump. But not a whole lot up here, but a lot of my friends are saying they're going down to Milwaukee, down to Janesville and Madison, and there's huge turnouts everywhere. And I've been watching on Twitter a lot of the posts, and people are fired up, that's for sure.
So you didn't see any Hillary signs there?
No, you know what? I actually, which is funny, I saw 2 Hillary bumper stickers, but they both said Hillary for prison 2016. So that's the best Hillary sign.
Oh, that Wisconsin humor. You know, it's
right?
Interesting because, you know, down here, I've actually been kind of surprised at the lack of signage. I know our primary is over, but even before the primary, I was kind of surprised at the lack of signage and bumper stickers. I have seen a couple of Bernie Sanders yard signs, and then I've seen one, like, generic. It just says, vote for Democrats. There's no name on it, but I've not seen, to this day, I haven't seen any Hillary Clinton yard signs. I think I may have seen a bumper sticker around the Longwood University campus, but I've been kind of surprised at the lack of it.
I just remembered this. She has an ad running. My husband and I saw it last night. She has an ad running in Wisconsin, and it's pro-choice and pro. And I'm thinking, wow, up here in the north side, like from Milwaukee north, you're off base, just completely off base. So I wonder how that's going to hurt her or help her. I don't know.
I guess we'll see tomorrow, right? And then it'll be over, and then the electoral tsunami moves on to another market, and things will calm down there. Are the campaign ads? Are you seeing a lot of TV ads everywhere you go now, or when you?
We're seeing a lot of stuff for Cruz. I haven't really seen a lot of stuff for Trump, which is interesting.
Huh. Well,
yeah,
you know,
a couple for Sanders, and then like that one last night for Hillary.
Trump's getting a lot of the earned media.
Exactly.
You know, I don't think he has to spend a lot on TV ads.
No.
So you know, tomorrow, again, I think turnout is going to be higher than normal. We've seen that in other states around the country. And I'm guessing that there are going to be hundreds of thousands of voters who are also concealed carry holders who will be out voting. As it turns out, y'all have quite a few concealed carry holders in the state these days.
We do. I'm so impressed because our Act 35, which is our concealed carry law, went into effect November 1st of 2011, so the very late end of 2011. And last week, Attorney General Brad Schimmel said that we issued our 300,000th concealed carry permit in the state of Wisconsin. So it's just wonderful. I mean, we've gotten so much good feedback in our community and throughout the state that people are taking the courses, applying for their permits, and really actively training. So that's what's more important than getting the permit itself, is actively training, continuing your education, and really being proficient with that weapon.
Absolutely. You know, and this is not, I'm very excited for Wisconsin, but as you well know, Jen, this is not the only state. Y'all are not the only ones in the country seeing these record high numbers. In fact, Minnesota, and I know you really don't want to be compared to Minnesota, but they also are seeing record high numbers. I think they're over 600,000. Now, their permits have been around longer than Wisconsin's has. I mean, you talk about really 5 years. And you already have 300,000 permit holders. You know, this is something that clearly there was a demand for this. Clearly there was a real desire among a lot of Wisconsins to be able to carry a firearm for self-defense, and they couldn't. I mean, you know, people forget Wisconsin was one of the last states in the country to adopt a law that allowed for any carrying of a firearm for self-defense, which kind of tells you, I guess, how far we've come, Jen, that it's only been 5 years, and really it is easy to forget Wisconsin was one of the last holdouts.
No, exactly. And, you know, here's the progression. So I don't even count 2011 because it didn't go into effect until November 1st. So really you're looking at 2012 to 2015,
mm-hmm.
You know, and the first 2 months of 2016. That's impressive. But in the whole year of 2015, 45,000 concealed carry applications were processed in the state of Wisconsin. And so far in 2016, 19,000 have been processed. So we are just going to fly right past our totals for last year, which is so impressive. It's not just, hey, they were really excited. They all came out and there was a big rush to everyone to get their concealed carry permit. No, it's growing consistently. So that's awesome. I'm so happy to see this.
And I have not seen a lot of stories, Gen X. To be fair, I haven't seen any stories indicating that these hundreds of thousands of concealed carry holders are committing hundreds of thousands of crimes in Wisconsin.
I have not covered one yet.
So, good to know.
Looking for them. I really do, because I'll call it out when I see it, but I have not seen it. So,
I haven't seen it either. And it's not to say that crime doesn't exist. Again, we've seen, you know, Milwaukee violent crime is, increased last year, but again, not being committed by concealed carry holders. You know, to that end, when somebody like Sheriff David Clark says, hey, you know what, I want you to go out and protect yourself, I want you to have some skin in the game, what kind of impact do you think messages like that have had in Wisconsin?
I think that the law-abiding gun owners who respect that whole mentality that Sheriff Clark stands for, and I think a lot of us stand for as well, and the NRA, to be honest, I think that resonates with us, and we take it very seriously, and it's not just a right. We feel that it's our duty, not only to protect ourselves, but to protect our loved ones. And I wrote about this yesterday on Bearing Arms, that I really and truly believe that it's more than just a God-given right protected by the Second Amendment. It is our duty. I have a duty to myself as a mom and as a wife to protect myself. And I have a duty to my husband and my children to also protect them. And I just see more and more people, not only in the state of Wisconsin, but across the country, also embracing their duty and their right to carry for protection.
And it seems like this has, you know, also sort of influenced the landscape of Wisconsin physically as well. I mean, I know you've got at least, well, how many quote unquote country clubs do you have in the state now?
Well, I went to one in Brookfield. That one is pretty darn nice. I mean, there's a little one, and we have one going up. I will say this: there is one going up because I know the owners in Bellevue, Wisconsin, right outside Green Bay. And this one's going to be a really big deal. So I think that'll be the first official country club, though.
Really?
And that's going up. I think they break ground this year.
So we are seeing the economic impacts, you know, are starting to be felt. Nobody invests that type of time and that type of money in a passing fad, right?
Right. and 2 years ago, remember when we covered, when I was on your show covering country clubs, mm-hmm. and you were talking about, I think it's Elite out there. And I'm going, I have an outdoor one by me, so I don't even get to shoot in winter. Well, now there's one at least, you know, 25 minutes from me. I think there's one going up in Grand Chute. You were seeing them in Brookfield. I mean, they're going up across the state. Now we have this huge one going up in Bellevue. That's going to be a draw, not just for, you know, Green Bay, but the surrounding counties are really going to benefit from that. And I just hope more entrepreneurs and business owners, they're paying attention because there is a market and they can really take advantage of that.
Absolutely. Well, listen, enjoy Election Day tomorrow.
Will do.
And good luck. I'm pleased to hear you volunteering to make sure that folks are going to the polls. That's
I do
awesome.
Every year. I love talking to all the old folks. Who knew?
Yeah.
Ben loves talking to people.
and unlike some people, you don't tell them who to vote for, right?
I don't. Nope. I'm just happy to. I talk to them on the way, and usually they tell me the gossip from the old folks' home or what's going on, and we just chat, and I'm just happy to bring them there.
Do you find them to be low-information voters or high-information voters?
I find
mix?
Them to be, I'll be very honest with you, I find them to be sweet little old men and ladies who sit in their homes and watch NBC and ABC and believe everything that they tell them.
Okay. Uh-huh. do you agree with Gawker that these individuals who you are taking to the polls tomorrow, are they too old and frail to defend themselves? Do they leave self-defense to someone younger?
Well, I covered that on Bearing Arms, but I have to say, when I was down at that new gun range in Brookfield, there was a 76-year-old woman who had gone in there to shoot a gun for the first time. She had a revolver. I mean, she showed up to play, and she was awesome. She did a great job, and she said, oh, I just feel so much better leaving. I'm not scared of it. I'm actually really good. I'm like, you are really good. And she was completely proficient, absolutely. And, I mean, more power to you. I love to see that.
There you go. All right. Well, listen, enjoy the rest of the snowfall there. Hopefully it's not going to be too bad. And I look forward to talking again very soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Cam.
All right. Have a good one, Jen. Jen Jakes, join us from Bearing Arms here on NRA News, Cam and Company. You know, it's interesting talking about ranges in Danville, Virginia. To our southwest here in Farmville, there's a guy who's hoping to open up a indoor shooting range. Phil Strader is his name. There was a, a city council meeting there. No opposition from the public, although apparently there's been some opposition from some city council members. I went before the planning commission to answer questions about sound rules, regulations. The guy has a law enforcement background. He says he previously owned an indoor shooting range outside of the Washington, D.C. area. Building plans include a shooting area, offices, training classrooms, and more. Two schools nearby, WDBJ says. Letters sent out to neighboring residents and businesses about the plan. Last week, the school board voted against the proposal. Mr. Strader says, is this building going to be any risk to the school or any business inside 300 feet, more or less outside 300 feet? Absolutely not. Well, the school board voted no, but the planning commission voted yes, apparently 6-1. And now this is going before the Danville City Council. So in Danville, Virginia, we may see a new indoor range. Also, you've got a new range opening up outside of the D.C. area in Prince William County. It's nice to see, by the way, the state of Virginia, where, again, there's been a fairly concerted effort on part of anti-gun activists for a while now to try to get the culture changed here in the state. Fewer gun owners makes it easier to pass more gun control laws, after all. It's nice to see that there are actually ranges opening up in the state of Virginia. All right, still to come, Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report will be with us on the program talking about another Virginia story. George Mason University announcing that it will name its law school after the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And some folks, probably the same ones who were gleeful when it was first reported that Justice Scalia had died. Yeah, these are some of the same folks who now have a problem with naming the law school at George Mason University after Justice Antonin Scalia. Let's see. Here's one quote. Good Lord, you are de-emphasizing the name of a founding father to honor a man who fetishized. Now, that's how he spelled it. I know that's not how you're supposed to say it. The beliefs held at the founding. A guy who didn't go there, have any connection to the school, who wouldn't have hired a George Mason law student as a bathroom attendant, much less a Supreme Court clerk. Oh, good Lord. Mm-hmm. Well, and Peter says that's one of the nice ones. So why is it that there is such a vociferous objection? By the way, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg said she thought it was a wonderful tribute to her friend and colleague, if you're on the left and Ruth Bader Ginsburg says, oh, I think that's nice, does that give you pause at all or not? Clearly for these folks, the answer is not. But we'll talk about it with Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report right after a quick timeout here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company.
I'm speaking with Mark Gilardi with Shoot for a Cure. Mark, thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us, what is Shoot for a Cure all about?
Shoot for a Cure, we're a national nonprofit. This is our 14th year. We go all over the country. We raise money for folks with leukemia, people with MS, and various other charitable causes. And since we've started, we've introduced over 1,600 people, new people, to the shooting sports, to sporting clay shooting, and we've raised $2.9 million net.
Wow.
For leukemia research, MS research.
So how did this all start?
On a dare. We were pheasant hunting, and somebody was commiserating about all the stupid golf tournaments we have to do, and somebody says, well, we should do a pheasant hunt for charity. I said, nah, if you do a pheasant hunt, you're not going to get anybody. I said, but if you did a sporting clay shoot, you'd get people to come. And it was like everybody just stopped, and they looked at each other, and they went, okay, do it.
Do we have an aha moment?
Yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I'm like, okay. And so we did the first year, and we had, I think, 70 shooters. We raised $12,000. And we did that for a couple of years, and then people started calling. Hey, can you bring that event up to Spokane? Can you bring that event to Southern Cal? Because we're out in Northern California. So, okay, we can do it. So then we had to figure out how to do the road show. Okay, what do we need? We need guns. We need sponsors. We need a trailer. We need a staff. So I talked to people in the industry that I knew. We all became certified instructors. We got a trailer. I came to my first SHOT Show, met Scott and met Carlo. And
how many years ago was that?
That was 14 years.
Oh, man.
So, and it was amazing the response we've gotten. And now we started with one event in Northern Cal. This year coming, we're going to have 17 events coast to coast. My program goal is $650,000. By the way, I forgot to tell you, last year was our record. When I first started this, I said to my buddy, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could shoot all over the country and raise $500,000 for kids with cancer? And he says, yeah, that'd be nice. Well, guess what? We did it last year. $516,000 net we're sending to those charities. And we had 1,530 shooters at our events.
Wow.
It's awesome. And every year at some point in this show, I will cry. Because I'm just a big softie.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, you've got, and I love it, you have passion, you have enthusiasm. What? And you've been doing this for 14 years.
Yeah.
What keeps that fire alive in you to do this?
A couple of things. I met some patient heroes a couple of years ago. And when you see the kids and they're standing there and you know the little girl's got a wig on. She's been through hell. I can say hell, can I?
Yeah.
Been through hell and she still manages a smile on her face. And I've got two daughters. And you just go home and hug your kids, and you thank God. And then it's like, I can help. We can do something to help. 2 years ago, leukemia came out with a new form of research. they took the HIV, the AIDS virus, and they took the stinger out of it, you know, the stuff that makes us sick.
Right.
And they retrained those T cells to, instead of attacking healthy cells, they're attacking cancer cells. And there's a video on our website called Fire with Fire, Leukemia Senate, said, put this on your website. I cry every time I watch it. This girl was 2 weeks from dead. She was blue. They've tried everything. Just as a last-ditch effort, they did this, and they almost lost her. And 48 hours later, the color came back to her body. And it was like 6 years ago, 8 years, like now, she's living a normal, healthy life. And now, because of what they did with that virus, it's transforming into, it's going to change bone cancer, it's going to change breast cancer, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, and Mark, and all that on top of that, you're introducing people, instead of going to a golf tournament,
right,
into the shooting sports and kindling or rekindling right. a love for that as well.
Absolutely. You know how many people we see, they're like, they come out and they go, you know, I haven't shot this gun since I was 10 years old. Or, this is my grandpa's 870.
Yeah.
And you get it and it's like, so I have an armorer. Remington gives me parts. We send it to the armorer. They clean it up. They put new seals in it, new piston. The guy goes out, and he's happy. He's having that experience he last had when he was 10 years old, and we're giving it to him. And we're raising money for kids,
Mark, how can people get more information about Shoot for a Cure?
Go to the website, shootforacure.us.
Welcome back to your first source for Second Amendment news and information. It is NRA News, Cam and Company. So, George Mason University up in Northern Virginia, the main campus is there in Fairfax, Virginia, where the NRA headquarters is located. The law school is over in Arlington, Virginia, and last week the law school announced that it is going to rename itself the Antonin Scalia School of Law there at George Mason University. Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report says there are some folks on the left who are losing their minds about this. Peter, how you doing, sir?
I'm fine, Cam. How are you?
I am excellent. So, what's the problem here? We announced yesterday or last week when we were talking about this, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a friend of Justice Antonin Scalia, said that she thought this was lovely, thought that it was appropriate for her friend and her colleague. Who could have a problem with this?
Well, Justice Ginsburg is, by many standards, a reasonable person. The snowflakes on college campuses and the left-wing academics who are safely in their ivory towers, who fuel all this nonsense, are not reasonable. They don't want to see Scalia, who is, in my view, the most important influential justice of my lifetime thus far, and is probably one of the 10 or 15 most influential jurists to ever serve on the Supreme Court, to be honored in any kind of a serious way. They want to be able to marginalize him as an irascible crank, as a racist, as an anti-woman bigot. They don't want his majority opinions to stand, and they don't want his minority opinions to influence future decisions. Putting his name on a law school, and let's I want to point out here that while a lot of people haven't heard of George Mason University, the law school has been consistently in the top 50, as ranked by my magazine, U.S. News and World Report, since it was created in 1978 or 1979. Their whole approach is a law and economics approach, which examines the intersection of economics and the law. It is a growing field of legal scholarship. It is producing bright lawyers who are bringing a new market-based approach to the law, which is, I think, sorely needed. We have too many judges on the bench still, from Johnson and Carter and Clinton and now Obama, who are more concerned about the outcomes than they are with the law. And so they've twisted the law, as Justice William F. Douglas famously talked about, was it the emanations coming from the penumbras of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause that twisted the law so that they can say what they want to achieve. Political objectives that they want to achieve are acceptable. That's where these leftists want American jurisprudence to go. And holding up Scalia as a as the towering legal figure he is by putting his name on a law school is unacceptable.
Talking again with Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report. And you know, as you say in your column, this small-mindedness, not just towards Scalia, but towards the very idea of the university as a place where rigorous intellectual discourse is expected, will inevitably kill the left. They cannot defend against ideas that they oppose but do not understand, and they cannot increase their understanding by gagging those with whom they disagree and by erasing them from the record. But that is sort of what they are left with now. They don't want to confront. You know, look, we see this in the gun control argument all the time, Peter. You know, the left, I shouldn't say the left, because there are people on the left who actually are Second Amendment supporters. Anti-gun activists base their worldview when it comes to firearms on that premise of more guns equals more crime. Even when that has been proven to be demonstrably false, that is still what they base their principles on. That's dogma to them. And when they can't confront all of the evidence that runs to the contrary, what are we left with? Well, you're paranoid, you're this, you're that. You know, all of a sudden the argument becomes personal.
Yeah, they do it on other data points too. When they talk about cop killer bullets and plastic guns and even the so-called assault weapons ban. You know, guns are guns. And they may do within a certain lane, different things differently, and some of them may look more menacing or more cool than others, depending, I suppose, on your perspective. You know, the left wants to argue about what they look like, and they want to argue about things that don't exist. And when you try to make this explanation, when you try to explain that to them, when you try to have a rigorous debate, they shut you out because they don't believe it. And ultimately, that's why they're going to lose, because you are always going to have to defend your positions in the American political system. The people expect it. And once you get outside of an academic environment like a university into the real world, we have to start talking about real world things, you know, real world situations that affect profit and loss, life and death, sickness and health, prosperity and poverty. And at that point, you can no longer stand, you know, it's like the old joke about the two economists who fall down a hole and they can't get out. And the first one says, I know how we're going to get out of here. First, assume a ladder. You can't do that in the real world. And that's why ultimately they don't succeed. Once the evidence is clear to the vast majority of the American public, and obviously supporters of the Second Amendment are better educated on their issue than the public at large. But on most issues, once people pay attention, they understand, oh, okay, I get it. The center-right position makes sense. It's where I am. This left-wing position is nonsense. Now, if you can't defend against your opponents in a debate, you end up looking silly. And that's too often what happens to them, because they don't understand the arguments on the other side. They can't counter them.
Peter, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is always a pleasure talking with you. And, you know, again, we see evidence of this, not just at George Mason University, but, you know, you can look at the chalk protests that we've seen all across the country. And now this sort of counter push where I think you have people who probably, you know, aren't really political supporters of one candidate or another, but now they know, oh, we can do this, and we can push the snowflakes buttons. And you know, we're not going to get in trouble because it's chalk. So I think we might actually be seeing and will continue to see more of a pushback on campus as, you know, these other voices sort of find their footing.
Well, I certainly hope that's the case. I mean, universities are supposed to be places where intellectual exploration is
demanded and where vigorous debate occurs. I love vigorous debate. I have a number of very close, dear friends who are liberals, and we get along just fine because we talk it all through. And sometimes they show me where I'm right, and sometimes I show them where they're wrong. But no matter how it goes, we're able to talk it out. The fact that you can't talk it out because you're afraid of losing is anathema to human behavior. It won't stand up in the court of public opinion.
Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report. Thank you as always, sir. Look forward to doing this again very soon.
Thank you. USNews.com.
Make sure you check out Peter's latest column. I'm sure we'll be tweeting it, if we have not already, at Cam and Company on Twitter. Valinda Rowe of Illinois Carry coming up next hour. Talk about the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day. It is this Wednesday in Springfield, Illinois. Antonia Okafor with Students for Concealed Carry, the Southwest Regional Director of Students for Concealed Carry. It is getting a little personal in Texas, at least according to one of the Texas papers down there. In Georgia, Governor Nathan Deal still has the campus carry bill on his desk, has until May the 3rd to veto the legislation, sign the legislation. If he does nothing, then the bill becomes law. So in some states, if the governor doesn't act, then the bill is automatically vetoed. Georgia is one of those states where if the governor does not act, then the bill becomes law. There have been protests as well as supporters on college campuses there in Georgia who have been, you know, publicly demonstrating there in the campus square. So far, by the way, it appears as if people are able to have a discussion, even a passionate one, about this without any of the horrible things happening that the opponents of campus carry say will inevitably happen. At the University of Georgia, they had a protest slash rally last week. The Valdosta Daily Times reporting that protesters and students there at Valdosta State protested on Friday morning. Looks like this was part of the campaign to keep guns off campus, which I believe is that part of Everytown now, Cameron, or is that part of the Brady campaign?
I don't know.
I'm not one of the anti-gun groups there. Sponsoring the protest. The group of professors and students talked to passersby about the bill, trying to get them to join the protest by warning them about what they call the potentially dangerous consequences of the legislation. Dr. Matthew Richard, associate professor of anthropology, said the bill's passage would make him question his safety, the opposite of the bill's intent. Said, quote, think of all of the ways that students can get angry. You can give back an exam, but a student has failed for the third or fourth time. There's a lot at stake. When the stakes are high like that, I don't think you'll want anything that'll bias the decision-making. Now, there's actually, you know, keep in mind, grade inflation's been going up in universities for the past couple of decades. There was actually a story I saw last week about this. The number of A's being given out has skyrocketed, which in part, maybe it's a cause or effect, right, for the precious snowflakes there who can't handle criticism. They have to get that A. But again, what are you seeing right now? What does that student do right now when they failed for the third or fourth time? What is their reaction right now? Do they get up? Do they spit in your face? Do they pull your hair? Do they punch you? Do they cry? Do they wet their pants? Do they run out of the classroom? Do they quit? What do they do now? Because that's probably what they're going to do. You know, again, we're talking about people who are concealed carry holders, people who are already carrying off campus, who may get bad news, who may get, you know, cut off or stuck at a red light, may deal with a rude clerk, and who somehow managed to navigate all of those things without whipping out their gun and committing a crime. Already, all over the state of Georgia, they're doing this. But this college professor, Dr. Matthew Richard, says, I don't know. these students, they get angry. Catherine Grant, the Southeast Region Director for the Campaign to Keep Guns Off Campus, joined the protesters, urging them to call the governor's office. She said social media is big right now. You can even text his office. The more people, the better. The professor also says, quote, guns are a real menace to the whole process of higher learning. Higher education is competitive. What is introducing lethal force going to do to that process? There are just endless questions on the issue. Okay. There are. It's also clearly a need for some education on this issue. And what's sad is you'd like to think that a college professor would want to educate himself or herself on the issue before immediately engaging in a full-fledged freak-out. At least I'd expect that from a college professor, an educator at an institution of higher learning, but nope. Apparently we don't get that these days. Stick around. Hour two of NRA News. Cam and Company is coming up right after this.
It's really an honor here to have Ted Kyle here. You walked through this SHOT Show, and the people, like, as you were coming here to our set, you're stopped, like, every 5 feet. People just want your picture. They want to talk to you. But you were recently part of the CNN town hall on guns, and you asked the first question of the president, so I'm sure a lot of people who didn't know who you were now know who you were. You know, the power of CNN, of course. Did you get mostly a positive or a negative reaction from people who've never heard of you before?
That's a good question. I haven't, if they felt negatively, and I'm sure there are plenty who did, I haven't heard from them, and I don't know if it's because I'm not out there looking for the negative comments necessarily,
right,
or if it's because the people who feel negatively haven't wanted to necessarily come up and talk to me.
Yeah.
I did get, right after the show was over, there were some people who came up and very respectfully were very kind, yeah, but kind of told me their views on their loved one that had died, and that right, they felt maybe a different form of background check would have helped more, and they were open to having a small dialogue about it, and I was glad for that, because I think that's part of the problem, is that there isn't enough respectful dialogue of both anybody's opinion. Can we not just talk about it and not be hateful about it?
Yeah. You know, you're here at the shooting industry trade show. Your husband was associated with shooting, of course, American Sniper. He was killed by a gun that is represented here at the show. Do women and people go up to you and say, how can you support an industry that led to the death of your husband? And what do you say back to them?
Well, it's an interesting thing. Like, you know, as you said, a gun that killed my husband, right? It wasn't the gun.
Right.
And it was the person. And I know that sometimes people feel like that's a trite difference, but I've gone over and over it in my mind. And I think you do that anytime you lose somebody you love. And I think the Chris's and Chad's case, Chad was killed with Chris, is a little bit different in that this is a person who was an armor. The murderer was an armor in the military. He had access to guns all the time and never killed anyone. When he got out and started making different life decisions, and I think from what I heard in the trial, it's my opinion, he was enabled a lot and has been seen as the victim a lot. But yeah, the biggest thing was that he got out of a lot of trouble by claiming PTSD. And the police would say, okay, well, let's take you to a mental facility instead of taking you to jail. And then they would. In the mental facility, they didn't see any PTSD. What they saw was something other than psychosis, which is kind of a term for drug use. And they would release him because they couldn't talk to the police because of HIPAA laws. I wish they could have said, hey, look, this guy claimed that he had PTSD. That's a legit disease, but that's not what this person has, or a disorder, a temporary disorder situation that you have. So I think we could go to that, and we could also go in Chris's and Chad's instance in particular. His mother, Chris, talked to his mother, and from my understanding, said, would your son like to go to a shooting range? And she said, oh, yes, and didn't explain. What we also learned in trial was that a few months before, he had threatened to kill himself and his whole family, so they had the guns removed from their home.
Right.
And so I don't want to be too long-winded, but I do want to get to that point for you, because I think that's at the root of it. Would Chris have helped him? Yes. But would he have taken him to a shooting range? No. There was information he didn't have. And it wasn't that he had PTSD, because PTSD people don't typically, I mean, I don't know that I know of any cases where they've murdered someone because of that. They've right, hurt themselves, but not murdered someone else. So there was no threat that Chris could have known. I can also tell you that this person, and I think this is true of a lot of people who murder, that it's not as often a crime of passion. This person thought about killing Chris and Chad on the drive down. He didn't do it because he didn't want to get hurt. At least that's what he said in some of the testimony. And so he waited until their guns were empty. He waited until they weren't looking, right? And so I think that if you boil that all down into all these situations, how do we identify the person who has the ability to murder? Because the gun owners I know, and I know quite a few of them, the human heart is not built to murder.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Valinda Rowe with Illinois Carey coming up later on in the hour, talking about the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day, where thousands of gun owners will descend on Springfield, Illinois. It's coming up this Wednesday. Also, Antonia Okafor with Students for Concealed Carry will join us on the program. We'll talk about what's going on in the state of Texas, where things are getting a little personal, it looks like, in the campus carry fight. Meanwhile, Beverly Cleary, do you remember her, Cameron? Did you ever read Ramona and Beezus and Henry and Ribsy and those books growing up as a kid?
Remember the name. Did not read the books, no. But an iconic name for sure.
Absolutely. My kids are now reading. My daughter is reading Beverly Cleary books. She's turning 100. Wow. Congratulations to Beverly Cleary. The Washington Post has a story and an interview with Beverly Cleary, who says that kids today don't have as much freedom as she did growing up. She said, I think children today have a tough time because they don't have the freedom to run around as I did, and they have so many scheduled activities. In her youth, she pointed out, mothers did not work outside the home, they worked on the inside. And because all the mothers were home, 99% of them anyway, all mothers kept their eyes on the children. She says this is part of the reason that the kids in her books were so often out tromping through the neighborhood without adult chaperones. Huh. Last book came out in 1999 when she was, 100, wow, in her 80s. How about that? Born in rural Oregon, spent much of her life doing farm work. When her family moved to Portland, she says city life was a shock, even back then. Surrounded by hipsters. No, probably not. Although her mother read to her regularly, she wasn't always eager to read on her own. She said, I'd like to have her read to me. So I thought, what's the point in having to do it myself? Beverly Cleary did not learn to read until the third grade. How about that? Anyway, you know, we talk a lot about the free-range kids on the program here. And, yeah, I suppose it's easy for someone who is a centenarian to say kids don't have as much freedom as they did when I was growing up. What's sad is that you don't need to be a centenarian to say that, do you? You could be in your 30s and say that. Heck, you could probably be in your 20s and say that. Of course, we could also have adults look up from their adult coloring books and say, yeah, you know what, kids really don't have as much freedom as I did growing up. Right? But it is worth pointing out that, you know, this really is accurate. This really is true. Look at Julie Gunlock's experience. Julie's going to be with us on the program tomorrow. And we talked with Julie last week about her run-in in the parking lot of the grocery store there, where Julie was accosted for leaving her kids in the car for like 5 or 6 minutes while she ran inside the store. This is just not seen as normal anymore. Lenore Scanese over at Free Range Kids pointed out that the Girl Scout cookie program requires that high school seniors need an adult to supervise their cookie selling. Lenore says at first she thought the wording read girls ages 6 to 12 must be supervised by an adult when selling door to door and must never sell alone. Girls grade 6 through 12 must be supervised there selling
Girl Scout cookies. You could be an adult, actually. You could be 18 years of age and still need that supervision, apparently. Anyway, we'll talk more about this with Julie Gundlach coming up on the program tomorrow. Now, I mentioned when we were talking with Jen Jakes last hour that Wisconsin, with 300,000 concealed carry holders, a new record for the state, not the only state that is setting records. Minnesota up to 600,000 concealed carry holders. The Detroit Free Press, with a story yesterday, Christina Hall, says Macomb County is on track to double the number of applications for CPL permits in a typical year. She starts with a personal story. Scott and Sherry McCullough. They have been around firearms for years, she writes, but they have not felt the need to carry one until recently. First, there was the February 10th incident involving a woman who stabbed her mother outside of the GM Tech Center in Warren, where Scott McCullough works. And where a valet supervisor pulled out his concealed pistol, stopping the brutal attack. And then there were random shootings by an Uber driver who killed six people and wounded two others in Kalamazoo in a rampage just 10 days later. Geez, anything can happen, said Scott McCullough, with his wife finishing the sentence. Anytime. Last month, they arrived at the county clerk's office together to submit their concealed carry paperwork. Again, on pace right now to double the number of concealed carry holders compared to last year. They have hired additional staff to help process the influx. Detroit Free Press says, although the jump in applications is more pronounced there in Macomb County, both Oakland and Wayne, as well as other counties in the state, are also seeing more people apply for their concealed carry license. The Michigan State Police website says that as of March the 1st, there were 528,320 concealed carry holders in the state. By March 9th, that had grown 11,000. 539,036 concealed carry holders in by March 24th, so it was 24 days. The Detroit Free Press says the uptick started after a December 1st change in state law that in part speeds up the time to get a permit and eliminated the three-member county boards that approved or denied permits. That work now done by county clerks with state police conducting background checks on applicants. The Free Press says that if the office there in Macomb County continues at the pace that it is currently at, it will receive about twice the number of applicants this year than during an average year. The county commission recently approved $56,000 for two additional hires, temporary hires there to help vital records. The Wayne County Sheriff, Benny Napoleon, said that his office is experiencing a similar uptick in fingerprinting for concealed carry applications. It had been processing about 60 to 65 requests per day before the law changed in December. That has now grown to about 85 requests per day. He says he has not hired any additional staff, but he may. He said, quote, I think it's going to be steady. The Wayne County Clerk's Office received 5,258 concealed carry applications in December and January, nearly 1,800 more than in December of 2014 and January 2015. Wow. By the way, the sheriff there in Wayne County says he personally has, quote, no reservations about more people obtaining a concealed pistol license. He says his office doesn't have any problems with people carrying lawfully and that, quote, most problems are with people not carrying lawfully. Well, that is true. The Detroit Free Press, in its coverage, and again, this is a really beefy story. This was in the I think this was front page of the Sunday paper there. They return to the a couple who had signed up or applied to get their concealed carry license together. Scott McCullough said that he's very frugal. He's got three kids in college. He has a fourth who is going to be entering college. But he said the Kalamazoo tragedy in particular really hit him. And was enough for he and his wife to fork out $230 for the two concealed carry applications. Another $200, $198, for both to attend the CPO class, and about $600 for one firearm. Tom Vaughn is a owner of the firing line in Westland, Michigan. And he said his gun shop and firing range fills every concealed pistol license, and, quote, we're filling them up a little bit quicker now. They're right now, early May, scheduling, or early April, scheduling into May. Tom Vaughn, by the way, former police officer, who, again, wants people to be able to exercise their right of self-defense. Says his business has seen more women using firearms, obtaining them mostly for protection. He says in the past few months, he's also seen more first-time firearm buyers. Sam Daly, or DeLaley, rather, is a co-owner of Action Impact in Southfield, Michigan. He says they have classes three times a week, 45 to 50 people, and they are booked, quote, 2 days after we post them. He said within the last year, the business started offering a women's-only class with a female instructor. That is also filled up. And the gun shop and range opened a second location in East Point last year. Brad Donnelly, he's 45, Fraser, Michigan, applied for his concealed carry license, says that he wants it for personal protection. I said the possibility of changes in the law or of his rights being taken from citizens was a motivator in his decision, as was the fact that he has a custom cabinet and millwork company, often carries a lot of cash around. He wanted to be able to protect himself. 58-year-old Patrick Grace has been a gun owner for over 30 years, but he just got his concealed carry license a couple of years ago. Personal protection. He said, I just wanted to carry. My neighborhood's gone down. Says it also makes it easier for him to transport his firearm to Peter's Indoor Range and Gun Shop in Roseville, where he practices twice a week. Without the concealed carry license, he said he had to unload his gun and lock it in his trunk to go to and from the range. The Detroit Free Press also quoted 26-year-old Samantha Fisher, who got her concealed carry license 4 years ago when she was 22, probably right out of college. A lot of 22-year-olds still in college, though, you know, getting back to the campus carry argument. She works in marketing in downtown Detroit. And she says she got her concealed carry license because she works in a, quote, not-so-safe part of Detroit, and I'm a small person. She said that she has never had to pull out her gun. But she said that she was in a parking lot in Detroit a couple of years ago when a guy started following her around, getting progressively closer to her. Eventually, she said she turned, she lifted her shirt to show that her gun, and he turned and he walked away. There were a number of other gun owners quoted in this story, again by Christina Hall of the Detroit Free Press, a fairly detailed look at, again, those who are becoming concealed carry holders there in the state of Michigan. And all around the country, you will hear similar stories, which to me is one of the reasons why the argument against campus carry, the arguments that we are hearing against campus carry, are so ludicrous. Because these professors and students who are opposed to campus carry are acting like we don't have the ability to bear arms off campus right now. And we do. And again, there are hundreds of thousands of concealed carry holders in the state of Michigan. There are more than a million in the state of Florida. We're up to almost a million in Texas, over 900,000, over 300,000 in Wisconsin. Around the country, there are about 13 million concealed carry holders. I'm guessing by the end of this year, probably up over 14 million. Georgia has quite a few of them. I mentioned, what, 900,000 in the state of Texas. You know, these professors and students who are so worried about how a concealed carry holder is going to react to getting a bad grade, how they're going to react to a conversation or a viewpoint that they don't agree with. Look, not everybody's a snowflake. Most people are not snowflakes. That's kind of what makes the precious snowflake stand out, is that most of us aren't. So, again, those concealed carry holders, those who are already carrying off campus right now, they're not freaking out. They're not flipping out about every perceived insult or microaggression. Quite the opposite. Again, concealed carry holders in the state of Texas, far more law-abiding than the general population. I think that holds true across the country. And the only way that argument makes sense, well, you know, these people are just going to flip out and freak out, again, is if there was, and even then it wouldn't make a lot of sense, but the only way it could even be a credible argument is if there was no evidence whatsoever of concealed carry being implemented anywhere in the country. Not only can we look at concealed carry generally, we can look at campus carry that's been implemented around the country. When was the last time you saw a story out of Utah or the state of Colorado where campus carry has been in effect for years, talking about the gunfight that broke out over an argument or a classroom discussion? Or somebody got a bad grade. You know, again, I understand the emotional appeal of that argument. I do. I don't, logically, it makes no sense whatsoever, but I understand the emotional appeal. But these are, in many cases, educators who are making this argument. These are folks who get paid quite a bit of money, in part to help their students think critically about issues, to prevent those, not to prevent, excuse me, as a Freudian slip, I was going to say to present those opposing point of views. Actually, these days, it is more like prevent those opposing point of views from finding space on campus. Anyway, we're going to talk about this more with Antonia Okafor. The issue is not going to go away. Again, with the law going into effect in Texas later this year, Kansas, the law goes into effect in 2017. The bill before Governor Deal's desk in Georgia, you've got campus carry advancing in the state of Tennessee. This is going to be an issue that we are going to be talking about, I think, the rest of the year. And we will likely see, you know, a lot of the anti-gun antics like we've seen from gun-free UT, for example, on campuses across the country as well. All right, stick around. When we come back, we're going to talk about a truly productive grassroots movement, not opposition to campus carry, but IGOLD, the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day, the yearly trip to Springfield, Illinois, by thousands of Illinois gun owners, chance to meet and greet their local lawmaker and express support for the right to keep and bear arms and pro-gun legislation there in Illinois. Stick around. We will be right back with much more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking with Jim Sapieha, director of the NRA Museums. Jim, in this installment, we want to talk about the NRA National Sporting Arms Museum. Tell us what it's all about.
Well, that is the newest of our three museums. We have the NRA National Firearms Museum here at NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia. The NRA National Sporting Arms Museum was opened 2 years ago at the Bass Pro Shops in Springfield, Missouri, and it is a spectacular museum. There are about 1,000 historic arms there, and of course, as you'd guess, there's an emphasis on sporting arms, the arms of hunting, of sport shooting. But it goes far, far beyond that. We have exhibits that include guns of the Old West. We've got some great new guns that are just coming in and will be on display soon. Bat Masterson, Bass Reeves, who is a very iconic Old West figure. The first African-American U.S. Marshal west of the Mississippi, and one of the most prolific lawmen of the Old West in terms of number of arrests, number of gunfights, a remarkable Old West figure that has been mostly overlooked until just the past few years. That museum, the really gratifying thing about that museum is the attendance. We just hit a milestone, opened 2 years and 2 months, and we have had 700,000 people through that museum. And so it's almost 1,000 a day, yeah. Oh. And the demographics there, we get a lot of families, a lot of, you know, mom, dad, and the kids coming through. Right. And it's just great. And you see the parents pointing out the different things to the kids, and then the kids taking them by the hand and saying, come over here and see this.
How do we get more info about that museum?
That museum, all the NRA museums are at the website, nramuseums.com, or you can go visit the museum in Springfield, Missouri at the Bass Pro headquarters shop there. It's open every day of the year except Christmas, and admission is always free at all three of the NRA museums.
The only truly free people who have ever walked this earth have been armed people, capable of defending themselves and their families. Americans look in horror at supposedly free countries all over the world where innocent people live or die at the mercy of their government. We see what it's like to be French, German, or Belgian, where innocent people cower in fear as evil closes in, utterly aware of their own vulnerability, doomed to defend their families with rolling pins and broom handles. Let the rest of the world choose to live in fear. That false brand of freedom will never be ours. We are free to be as armed, trained, and prepared as we see fit. And we will never surrender that freedom to the global gun ban order. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I'm a mom, a business owner, and a patriot, but I am not a politician. A few years ago, I founded a nonprofit to defend voters' rights and stop election fraud. We exposed corruption, so the corruptors wanted me silenced. The IRS, FBI, ATF, OSHA, and a U.S. congressman turned my life upside down. Their investigations were invasive, abusive, relentless, and political. They demanded every social media message I'd ever posted, the name of every group I'd ever spoken to, and every word I spoke. I was supposed to give up, but I am not a victim. I'm an American, and I will not stand by and watch while our freedoms are picked off. An attack on one right is an attack on every right. So, I fight. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Your first source for Second Amendment news and information. It is NRA News, Cam and Company, coming to you from beautiful and bucolic Farmville, Virginia. Antonio Okafor, later in the hour from Students for Concealed Carry. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from Illinois Carry, our friend Valinda Rowe is with us. Valinda, how are you doing today?
Doing great, Cam. How are you doing?
I am fantastic. Thank you for coming on the program. It's always a pleasure talking with you. And this is a big week there for gun owners in Illinois.
It is. We are in Springfield now getting ready for the big day on Wednesday. Can you believe this is going to be our 10th Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day?
Oh, my gosh. That is amazing. And it's
the Illinois State Rifle Association has had a lobby day for decades, and it was 10 goals ago that we approached them about doing a joint venture inviting all the gun owners in the state of Illinois, and it's been a great success. Like you said, a grassroots movement that has just grown and grown.
It didn't even take you 10 years, Valinda, to get Carry in Illinois.
Actually, it took us 9 years to get the law passed, but 10 years before the first license was issued.
There you go. Almost a decade. But it does show, again, I think the power and the sustaining power of gun owners as voters, not just in the state of Illinois, but really around the country. You know, I know that anti-gun activists, they like to poo-poo the influence that gun owners have. They talk about the gun lobby as if it's just Wayne LaPierre and Chris Cox and, you know, whoever works in the building there in Fairfax.
But they, you know, I think really intentionally downplay the effectiveness of the real grassroots out there, the millions of American gun owners.
Yeah, and we can see firsthand how successful grassroots movement is. And like the NRA slogan, we are the NRA, the individual member. We make up that gun lobby that they try to cast aspersions against. But here in Illinois, we were fighting up against a Chicago carry bill, and we know it was the grassroots movement, the individual NRA, ISRA, and Illinois carry members that influenced their legislators, and we were able to pass a shall-issue statewide preemption. The carry law is the same from one end of the state to the other. We know it was that grassroots movement.
So this Wednesday, let's talk some nuts and bolts. If folks do want to attend, what's the best way to be a part of this? Whoop, Valinda, we lose you? We may have lost Valinda. Thought I may have stunned her speechless with that question. Seemed like kind of an easy one. All right, we'll see if we can get Valinda back with us here momentarily. We'll talk more about the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day taking place in Springfield, Illinois. Wow, it is hard to believe that it has been, this will be the 10th Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day. And really, if you've never been or if you've never seen our coverage, it's pretty cool. You know, especially you go back 10 years when the event was really just first getting started, see how it has grown and how many thousands of people attend each and every year. All right, I believe we've got Valinda back with us. You there, Valinda?
Yes, I am here.
Okay. All right, so just practically speaking, if people want to be a part of the event this week on Wednesday, what's the best way to join the festivities and join the fun?
Okay. For detailed information, they can go to igold.isra.org.
Okay. And you've got a schedule there?
But it's Wednesday, April the 6th. The schedule is all posted there. The rally, big rally at the Prairie Capital Convention Center is at noon. We march to the state capitol at 1. And then we'll have another rally in the rotunda at 3:30. Everybody will get a packet that they can deliver to their state representative, state senator, speaker of the House, president of the Senate, and a note to drop off with the governor.
And you all have charter buses coming from all around the state, too, right?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And those are listed on the website.
So if somebody has never been to one of these events before, Valinda, I mean, what is it like for you? What's your day like on Lobby Day?
I tell you what, it's really exciting, Cam, because what we're getting to do is exercise a constitutional right, our First Amendment right, to gather in a peaceful demonstration, go to our legislators, address our grievances, tell them, you know, what we want them to support, what we want them to oppose. It's a great patriotic movement and experience. Families come, moms, dads, they bring the children to witness how this is done and pass this on to the next generation. And we've got some great speakers that are going to be there. One of your safest place, Chris Eberhardt from Chicago, is going to be one of our speakers. Masad Ayoub is going to be one. So it's a big day, and it's a wonderful experience to be able to exercise that constitutional freedom in two forms, the First Amendment and the Second Amendment.
Talking again with Valinda Rowe of Illinois Carry. And you know, Valinda, this is, you mentioned Chris Eberhardt up in Chicago who's going to be speaking.
Yes. He is an Illinois Carry member and an Illinois State Rifle Association member.
You know, and he's from Chicago, where violent crime is through the roof this year. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not seeing a whole lot of stories about concealed carry holders being responsible for this violent crime in Chicago.
Not a problem. In fact, we've had several instances where concealed carry license holders, you know, used their firearm to protect themselves with, and we're seeing no charges filed, no arrests. So it's been very successful on the concealed carry side of the issue.
Are you worried and concerned that, law-abiding gun owners are going to continue to be blamed for the violence in Chicago? I mean, you know, we talk about this on the program on almost a daily basis, Valinda. You'll have a very small number of individuals in Chicago or Joliet or any other city in Chicago who are responsible for violent crimes, and yet the legislation, when a politician says we have to do something, their bills are aimed at the general law-abiding population of gun owners.
Right. They're aimed at the law-abiding gun owners, and they'll continue to do that, Cam. That is not something they're going to give up easy. They would have to address the real problems that are causing that type of violence in the cities, and they're not willing to do that. It's easier to use us as a scapegoat and blame the lawful gun owners when even in the city of Chicago, the people who live in the most dangerous neighborhoods, they know it is not the lawful gun owners causing these problems.
Valinda, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. It is always a pleasure talking with you. Have a fantastic time this Wednesday at the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day.
We are looking forward to it. Thank you for helping us get the word out.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure, and look forward to talking to you again very soon.
You bet.
Valinda Rowe with Illinois Carry. Again, if you want more information, you are an Illinois gun owner, you want to attend the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day, iGold, you can find out more info at igold.isra.org. Meanwhile, in Chicago, the Fox affiliate there, Fox 32, says that a Cook County commissioner is pushing a plan to reduce violent crime. And it doesn't involve gun control, by the way. Richard Boykin has a $50 million jobs bill, wants to put students to work, proposing a special use tax increase of 4 cents, an average cost annually of $28 per driver. He said, more than anything, Chicago youth want opportunities to work. He said, we've held youth summits throughout the city, and they've all said they want jobs. They want opportunities. They want alternatives to selling drugs on street corners. We need to put our young people back to work. Isn't it interesting they're not asking for free stuff so they don't commit violent crimes? The Cook County Commissioner didn't say, you know, what we're finding is that people are saying, well, give us money and we won't go out and shoot people. Nope. He's saying they want to work. They want to be productive. They want to do something with their lives. Again, they're looking for opportunities. And they don't have them. Now, I'm guessing, just guessing, since we're talking about a Cook County commissioner, I'm guessing that Commissioner Boykin is probably also fully in favor of any gun control law that you could think of. That's probably how it goes. But I think that it is interesting that what he is proposing is, again, trying to find some sort of opportunity for these individuals, some sort of legitimate opportunity, rather than working, dealing drugs on the corner, work at the corner store. You know, and again, this is one of the chicken and egg conundrums when it comes to taking a broken community and trying to turn it around. Obviously, jobs are a huge part of that. But what comes first? Do the jobs come into the, I don't even want to call them at-risk communities, because they're not just at risk. In many cases, we're talking about, you know, failed neighborhoods, where almost everybody but the good people living in them have given up on those neighborhoods. And it's only those good people living there that keep those neighborhoods even on life support. So do the jobs come back before the problems in the neighborhood get fixed? Or do you have to fix the problems in order for the jobs to come? Yeah, I don't know the answer. As I said, it's sort of a chicken and egg conundrum. But it does seem to me like it's going to be fairly difficult to ask businesses to invest in areas in which drugs and crime are out of control. That's going to be a harder sell. And again, what are they doing in Chicago right now? What has the law enforcement response been? What has the police, the city's response been? There has been so little action from City Hall. We talk about this all the time, but Cameron, again, when was the last time you saw a quote from Rahm Emanuel? Just a quote. Rahm Emanuel says X.
It's been a long time, and on April 1st, the Chicago Teachers Union went on strike, which you would think has propelled his name in the news. I can't say, I'm sure there are somewhere, but I've seen nothing but stories about the CTU. I have yet to see a Rahm quote. Maybe you have. I haven't seen. I'm sure someone asked City Hall what they think of the strike. He's the invisible mayor.
Chicago Sun-Times, this is yesterday. In the three-week run-up to a stunning selection of a new police superintendent, Mayor Rahm Emanuel juggled Chicago's pension, policing, and school funding crises with a heavy dose of image building. Mayoral schedules released in response to a Freedom of Information request by the Chicago Sun-Times show the daily balancing act that factors into how the mayor chooses to spend his time, whom he spends that time with, and even the restaurants where he chooses to dine with a friend, as the records put it. Six meetings labeled public safety update, chief of staff, public safety liaison, blah, 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 blah. A lot of behind-the-scenes stuff. During the same three-week period, Emanuel had just two meetings with Chicago Public Schools CEO Forrest Claypool, chief education officer Janice Jackson, and a host of top aides that included Arnie Rivera, senior advisor Mike Rendina, Chloe Ewing, blah, blah, blah. That's even though Chicago Public Schools running out of money with a $676 million pension payment due on June 30th and no help from Springfield in sight. Thousands of teachers, the Sun-Times says, massed in front of the Thompson Center on Friday for a one-day walkout. A mid-May strike is increasingly likely, and the on-time opening of schools this fall is a giant question mark. March 4th, Emanuel met privately. Interviews, private meetings at Aerial Investments, another meeting labeled Museum Update, held in the City Hall office. In an apparent attempt to rehabilitate Emanuel's public image, the three-week schedule is sprinkled with loads of media interviews and meetings with unidentified reporters labeled OTR, or off the record. Emanuel, the Sun-Times writes, has made a habit of holding these background sessions with the media since his days in the Clinton and Obama White House and in Congress in between. It's his way of explaining the strategy behind his most controversial decisions. He hopes to pave the way for more favorable coverage. Okay, here's... So you got a, what's the press term for it? Embattled mayor. You have an embattled mayor right now in Rahm Emanuel. You've got a crime rate that is soaring. You've got school systems that are bankrupt. You've got real big issues here. And it wasn't just our imagination. You really haven't heard a lot of quotes from Rahm Emanuel. Do you know why? Because he's talking to the press off the record. And the press going along with it. Press is fine, apparently, to report this. Is there any reporter, I wonder, you need more than one. Wouldn't it be lovely to see the Chicago Sun-Times and the Chicago Tribune, two papers that typically do not get along well with each other, along with maybe, I don't know, all of the broadcast news networks or local affiliates there in Chicago, release a statement. Mayor Emanuel, we don't want to talk to you off the record anymore. We want you to talk to the people of Chicago on the record. We don't want to carry your water. We don't want to try to give you good, favorable coverage. The city is at a crisis point, and you're worried about the optics. You're worried about your image. Well, Mr. Mayor, never let a crisis go to waste, as someone once said. And you are wasting this opportunity to talk to the people of Chicago. Now, maybe he doesn't want to talk to the people of Chicago. Maybe he has nothing to tell the people of Chicago other than we need to do something. But I got to tell you, if I lived in Chicago and my mayor was ducking the public, spending his days with private interviews and off-the-record conversations with the media, I would be a little torqued at the mayor. I'd also be a little torqued at the media who goes along with it. Apparently, he is content to let this crisis go to waste. All right, Antonia Okafor will join us on the program with Students for Concealed Carry. We've got to take a quick time out. Stick around. There is more NRA News, Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
I believe we have the former governor of Texas, Rick Perry.
That's who it looks like. Governor, I'm Steve Holbrook. Great to see you.
People say that all the time. They say, man, you know, you look like the former governor of Texas.
Yeah, sir.
Then I find out whether or not they actually liked him or not.
Yeah.
And then if they did, I just go, well, yeah, I'm... That's who I am.
Well, Governor, it's good to see you.
If not, I just go and say, yeah, you know, that guy is kind of...
How are you doing today?
I'm awesome, man. You kidding? Being at the SHOT Show?
How could you not be doing well, right?
How can you not be doing good here?
So next question, what are you doing here?
No, the question ought to be, why have you not been here every year in a row for the last 14 years? I mean, why did you miss any?
Right.
This is LaRue Tactical, one of my hometown boys, Leander, Texas. Mark LaRue's a great friend. I'm doing an event this afternoon with them. We're giving a LaRue OBR to the Sniper of the Year, a Marine. A young Marine will have a new weapon moving towards their possession as soon as we get to the appropriate place to register it
right.
properly.
Excellent. That is fantastic.
Yeah.
So this is your first time at SHOT Show? No? You've been before?
I've been before.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Well, and it gets bigger and better. I'm here with a friend who came at one of the first SHOT Shows. Like, I don't know how long they've been going on. This is like 14 years ago he came to the first one. He said, just in the last two or three years. Now, I don't know. Was it because we got a resident of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue that has created a lot of interest in owning weapons and tactical gear and what have you to defend your freedom and your family? I don't know, but whatever reason,
I have something to do with it.
It's been good for our country's economy. A lot of people in Texas, my home state, and a lot of people in some of those even blue states. Men and women have really good jobs because they're manufacturing goods that have been innovated right here because of the interaction that happened at the SHOT Show. And so I happen to look at the American defense industry, the American hunting industry, the American home defense industry as a great job creator for America based on our Constitution. Now, what could be better than that?
You know, I can't think of too many things, but the anti-gun advocates, they say maybe we should be making tofu or, close down the gun industry.
I'm looking for tofu in the Constitution. I hadn't found that
I
yet.
I believe it's an emanation of a penumbra it's a dangling participle or something.
Maybe First Amendment freedom.
Yeah.
So, Governor, how concerned are you right now? I mean, we've got Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Bernie Sanders. They're all saying that, they're trying to out anti-gun each other right now, say this is going to be a huge campaign issue for them. At the same time, look, we've got millions of Americans who are becoming concealed carry holders. I think support for the Second Amendment is strong. Do you think that Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and the other anti-gun folks, are they misreading the electorate, or are they just hoping to drag us all along to their point of view?
I don't know whether misreading the electorate or not, but this coming November, the American people need to send a powerful message mm-hmm. to both political parties, frankly. We obviously, I feel very comfortable that the Republican nominee, whoever that individual will be a powerful proponent of the Second Amendment and defending our gun rights.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to be sending a message across the board that this issue is settled. This isn't up for debate anymore. I mean, the idea that the Democrats somehow think, or Hillary Clinton, let me put it that way, I don't want to defend, I mean, there's some really good Democrats out there. I mean, there's a lot of good Democrats out there that are supporters of our Second Amendment and our gun rights, and God bless them for that. I hope they'll take the opportunity this election cycle to realize this may be the most important issue that they face when it comes to our freedoms and our liberties in this country, is defending Americans' right to defend themselves, the families. And Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Ed Al have made it clear that they'd like for us to be a lot more like Australia than America.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Coming up, top of the hour, Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense. Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom, Christian Toto of Hollywood in Toto. And right now, I want to welcome to the program the Southwest Regional Director for Students for Concealed Carry, Antonia Okafor. Antonia, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am excellent. I am excellent. I am sad that we didn't have you in studio today, but we'll see you in Louisville. I think we could probably do a National Hug a News Person Day or whatever there, right?
NRA edition. Yeah, we'll do that. That sounds like a plan.
I'm trying to think. I don't think that there are too many news people out there I'd like to give a hug to, you know? Firm talking to. The list goes on and on, but not too many people that I'd like to hug there in the media. What about there in Texas? Do you feel like Students for Concealed Carry, are you getting a fair shake from at least some of the press down there in the Lone Star State? Or not?
A fair shake. Yeah.
Not so much?
Not so much. I mean, of course, there's always those secretly, you know, off the record who are like, you know, I really love what you guys are doing. Yeah, but for the most part, we're having to agree to disagree most of the time.
So HoustonPress.com's Megan Flynn had a piece, The War Between the Pro and Anti-Campus Carry Groups Gets Personal. What is this? Now, she starts by talking about the allegation that you all are Tea Party funded. It's part of the Coke-tapus. The money's coming from the NRA. Basically, the allegation is you all are AstroTurf. You cannot be real grassroots activists. You're probably not even really college students. Antonia, you're probably like some 45-year-old CPA. But this can't be real. This can't be legit. That's basically what their argument boils down to.
Exactly, and that's the whole focus of it, really, for the most part. Like you said, the first part of, are we really a grassroots organization? Are we really student-led? Are the activists, do they get paid? I mean, what's going on here, and who's paying them? And it comes down from this article that The Trace, which they deem this independent news organization that is, you know, that we know of is funded by Everytown for gun safety. So definitely not independent, that brought up the allegations long ago that, you know, we're Leadership Institute funded and NRA, and, you know, advocates and et cetera, and partners and more conservative than, you know, Larry Pratt and his organization, everything, et cetera, et cetera. So all these allegations have come up. And for the most part, to me, in my conservative mind, I'm like, yeah, okay, cool. That sounds really awesome. But in the end, it's that they're trying to paint this picture of that we're funded, that we're not real, that we're not students, that we're not doing this movement that actually is catching on amongst students, because that means the worst, that students actually want campus carry, and that's terrifying to them.
Clearly. It is terrifying to them. I mean, we you know, so let's talk about the University of Houston, because it was at the University of Houston. We saw this slide, right? This had sort of gone viral online. PowerPoint slide advising faculty to be, quote, careful discussing sensitive topics, drop certain topics from your curriculum, don't go there if you sense anger, limit student access off hours. This is, again, faculty advice to other faculty members regarding campus carry, which shows the level of freak out, I think, among
Some of the faculty, not, certainly not all, but some of the faculty really truly seem to think, Antonia, that, that once campus carry goes into effect, there are a whole bunch of otherwise law-abiding students who have just been waiting for this to be their excuse to commit violent crimes.
Of course. I mean, the thing is that, I mean, these are professors. These are intelligent individuals. For the most part, it's to show really this self-created fear mongering of, you know, this is going to be really horrible. This is going to, you know, drastically change your environment and your climate and kind of build up this self, fulfilling, well, not self-fulfilling because it's not going to, and nothing's going to happen, but it kind of just this thing, fear, climate that people have to be afraid of, campus carry holders, of concealed carry holders. And it's false. And it's not based on facts, and it just kind of perpetuates this fear that's damaging and detrimental to the people who are going to have to, you know, conceal carry on campus and probably self-report in some instances if it goes to pass.
Talking again with Antonia Ogerford with Students for Concealed Carry, and so the personal nature of the war between the pro and anti-campus carry groups, as the Houston Press put it. What's going on with this? There's a faculty member at the University of Houston, Antonia, who has been one of the most vociferous critics of campus carry out there in the state of Texas. Is that fair to say?
Well, he's actually a undergrad student.
He's an undergrad student.
50-something-year-old undergrad student. I mean, that's what he tells us, or tells the public, at least. And, yeah, for several months, he's, you know, personally attacked me and social media stalked me and another regional director who used to be with us and now has moved on to another organization. But yeah, he's been doing that and basically bringing up these allegations of me, whether it's, you know, I've done these a propagandist or something like that.
Let me quote from the Houston Press here. He has specifically targeted Okafor, calling her a propagandist and criticizing her for supporting Ted Cruz and for writing libertarian articles on the right-wing website Campus Reform, which was founded by the Leadership Institute. How dare you, Antonia?
I know. Forgive me, please.
At long forgive last, have you it. No sense of decency writing libertarian articles? Oh, my goodness.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah, I prefer to, you know, self-title myself as conservatarian. I heard you're also a conservatarian, mm-hmm. So I'm in good company. So, yeah, I mean, this is the stuff that he's, like, again, stalking me and looking at my stuff. And it's concerning because of what we found is an arrest charge or arrest warrant for him saying that he, you know, committed battery towards a 19-year-old woman in 2001. And when I found out about that, you know, we were very concerned. SEC was very concerned for me and my safety. And my response was a good old you know, gun rights activist response was to go to the range for 4 hours and have Greg Taggart of Texas Legends completely do it for free for me and train me and help me and make sure that I'm prepared. So for anything that may happen. So it's just kind of, I mean, because people don't take those things seriously until it's too late. And that's what it comes back to. And that's why I'm passionate about gun rights and especially campus carry, because this stuff happens to women all the time, and it's time for the left to stop thinking or to stop saying that it has nothing to do with sexual assault or safety, because it comes down to that. It's part of it, and it's real.
You know, it's interesting. This article of the Houston Press quotes this guy. He said that he started advocating for restricting the law on campus or for entirely repealing the law in the state. After talking with many professors and faculty members about their opinions, he said, what I discovered, strangely enough, was this completely untapped vein of deep anxiety and concern and worry. And the more I got into it, the more I realized everywhere I turned, Students for Concealed Carry was involved in pushing for the law. So that untapped vein of deep anxiety and concern and worry, here's the thing. from what I've seen, Antonia, the opponents of campus carry aren't interested in having a conversation so that perhaps that untapped vein of anxiety and fear can be assuaged, right? We can, you know, we can talk about the concerns and we can, you know, explain how the law works. They want people to be freaked out about this. I mean, they don't want people to understand what the law is right now. They don't want people to understand who will be carrying. They want people to be scared as hell about this.
Exactly, because they know that once students know about the truth and know, I mean, I, you know, speak with students all the time. And, of course, there are several of them that they hear or they see my sign and, like, oh, women for gun rights or can still carry. Oh, my gosh, I think that's really scary. Then I talk to them one-on-one and tell them what the law actually implies. And then they're like, oh, okay, well, yeah, that makes total sense. That's common sense right there. You know, 21 years of age and older, that's faculty members, that's graduate students, responsible citizens. You know, they pass, you know, several background checks anyways. They have to do a CHL course. So, I mean, these students, once they know about the facts, then they're completely, for the most part, on board. Even the ones that, for the most part, might have said no if otherwise was spoken to. So they know that that's their only crutch right now is to perpetuate this misinformation. And whether it be that Students for Concealed Carry is this, you know, backed by such and such type group and it's not really grassroots group because that means it's not a student-led movement, and that's what it is, a movement, a modern-day gun rights movement, or saying that, you know, personally attacking me and my credibility or the people that are in this organization, that is because they're afraid of what the reality is, and that's that campus carry is here to stay and it's moving and students are on board.
Well, you keep up the fight, Antonia. It is always a pleasure talking with you. I look forward to seeing you soon, and we'll talk again sooner than that, I'm sure. All right, we'll talk very shortly. We'll be right back.
Speaking with Command Sergeant Major Patrick Valdez, he's retired, and he's now with Freedom Hunters. Patrick, thank you so much for being here, and we'll go right to the shot of what you tell us what you do, because this makes a very big impression when you wield this up to the set here. Tell us what's Freedom Hunters all about, and tell us about the chair.
Freedom Hunters, we're a nonprofit. We take all veterans, all wars, all branches, and outdoor shooting activities to include hunting, target shooting, trap, long range, whatever we can get the guy out. It started out with the Wounded Warrior program at Fort Carson, Colorado, and to get guys out of the barracks, kind of like what Healing Waters did. It's hunting and getting guys outdoors. When you get back from a combat environment, you want to go back and do the things you did before. You want peace, you want calm, you want quiet. And getting guys outdoors and gals is our primary mission.
So tell us about the chair you brought along.
The chair is an amazing device. It's the Action Track chair. It's an American-made. It runs 5 miles an hour. We can get guys, and I say guys mean guys and gals, into places they can't get with a normal wheelchair. Little skinny tires get stuck in the mud, stuck in the sand. We put them in this, and we can get them right to a blind. We can get them to a duck or a goose blind. We've taken them elk hunting, mule deer out west. We've even taken them fly fishing. With it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it can go into a little bit of water, not a lot.
Awesome.
It is battery operated. And it's just a great tool to get guys out. And it gives them independence. It gets the guys in a chair the freedom to get off the concrete and get into the snow, sand, dirt, whatever. And not have to worry about getting stuck.
So why did you do this?
You know, I started out as a patient in the program. I got injured in Iraq in February of 2007. And Freedom Hunters came to me and said, when they were really small, they said, we heard you want to go do something different. And I'd never been waterfowl hunting, so they took me, and that's how I started with them. So I was initially a patient in the program. Cool. Then I became a mentor. Now that I'm retired and have a little more time on my hands, I work as an outreach coordinator helping the guys out.
That's awesome. Talking with Patrick Valdez with Freedom Hunters. So, Patrick, I was out at Camp Perry one time at the Nationals there, and I knew exactly what you're talking about. There was another organization who worked with wounded vets, and they got them out hunting and shooting. Those guys just, you know, it's what they grew up doing. It's why a lot of them got into the service to begin with, and they're just so happy just to be getting out there again and just being out with the guys. It's
hugely impactful to them.
Well, it's an independence issue. You know, when they get back, they're well medicated, they're being taken care of, they have all of these appointments, and then they're like, I just want to go be by myself or get back into the wild. And especially at Camp Perry, it's a little sandy there.
Yeah.
And I've seen what wheelchairs do there, and they sink. And then all their buddies, usually four of them, drag them to the firing line. You know, and I've been on hunts where we didn't have a track chair available, and we had to drag the guy in his chair up to a blind.
Yeah. So something like that chair can't be cheap. So tell me, I'm obvious you guys probably need support. So we've got about 30 seconds left here. Tell us about Freedom Hunters. How can people get involved? How can they help out?
Freedomhunters.org, first of all. Come to our site. Vets can register and to get on a hunt themselves. Landowners can bring opportunities to shoot. There's the Independence Fund that's available, and Action Track Chair has their own 501c3 where there are scholarships available or funding available to get a chair on your own.
Patrick Valdez, Freedom Hunters, thank you so much for what you're doing, and thanks for being here on NRA News. Please keep up good work and stay in touch, okay?
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, we've got our friend Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom, Christian Toto of Hollywood and Toto, plus Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, and our Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcor Defense. In fact, let's get right to it. Our Hero of the Day from Fox 2 in St. Louis, Potosi, Missouri. They report a robbery suspect hospitalized in critical condition after being shot by the owner of the home. The Daily Journal newspaper in Park Hills, Missouri, reports that the shooting happened Thursday night in rural Washington County. Sheriff's Captain Zach Jacobson says the suspect and the homeowner are actually acquaintances. Sheriff says the suspect and another man apparently intended to steal prescription drugs from the gentleman. Jacobson says the two men threw the homeowner, who is an older man, hooked to an oxygen tank, onto a couch. There, the homeowner was able to grab a gun, shot one of the intruders. Both suspects then ran to a car, drove away before calling 911. Authorities believe the shooting was self-defense. The homeowner taken to the hospital, complaining of shortness of breath, abrasions, and bruising, but is expected to recover. And again, the one robbery suspect hospitalized. Trying to look to see what happened to the second suspect, if the second suspect was taken into custody. Sheriff says all indications show two suspects arrived at the residence. The homeowner appeared through the open door and saw people. He recognized one, but the other subject was wearing a mask, and they came into the residence demanding medication. About point after the suspect was shot, both suspects fled out of the residence and into a vehicle. Then they called 911. The second suspect, also a white male, is in custody and is at the sheriff's office being interviewed. Again, the sheriff says that they believe this is a self-defense act by the homeowner at this point. We'll keep our eyes on that story. Give me any more details as they become available. Remember, Gawker says that this man should not have tried to defend himself with a firearm because he is described as being elderly. Not in the best of health. Frail, perhaps, according to Gawker. Reflexes too slow, only going to hurt himself. No way should this guy have had a firearm. It's a good thing this guy doesn't read Gawker, apparently. All right, our deal of the day today from KIMA-TV. Now, the sentence that we're talking about is not actually the deal here. Yakima County, Washington. 30-year-old Darren Wright pleaded guilty 2 weeks ago to second-degree murder in the death of 54-year-old David Johnson. He has been sentenced to 18 years behind bars. Now, 18 years for murder, maybe that is a deal. Although the prosecutors were only asking for 13, the judge actually upped the sentence here. David Johnson
died after being beaten by Darren Wright, who was wielding a golf club at the time. He was with his wife. They were in Harlan Landing. She says they were playing golf. She stepped away to take a phone call. When she returned, she found her husband bleeding and beaten. She says, I kneeled down on one knee and I said, honey, it's going to be okay. Detectives say that the victim, David Johnson, and Darren Wright got into a religious dispute. Darren Wright was homeless at the time. He apparently wandered onto the scene there. Somehow, all of a sudden, they started talking about the religion. Wright, according to court papers, into witchcraft. KIMA says he is, quote, antichrist. And apparently that's what prompted the argument there. And then Darren Wright beat to death David Johnson with one of his golf clubs. He has a long criminal history, KIMA says, with 19 prior charges against him. He's 30 years of age. 19 priors. And again, the prosecutor in the case wanted 13 and a third years in prison. The judge said, no, I don't think that that is sufficient under the circumstances. I think this is a terrible loss to the community. I think you need to be locked away for the protection of society. Darren Wright apologized to the widow here, says, I was in a bad situation all around. I'd like to apologize to Teresa Johnson and the rest of the family. Teresa Johnson described her husband as a kind, loving man, a disabled veteran. She says, he was always so sweet and kind to me. I miss him so bad. I can't wait to be with him in heaven, she said. Meanwhile, Darren Wright will be out of prison before he turns 54. The age that David Johnson was when he passed away. 30 years now, 18-year sentence. He will likely not do the full 18, let's be honest. And Darren Wright, with 19 priors to his name, still out on the streets, literally homeless on the streets. Today's deal of the day. Our good guy today from WYFF in South Carolina, Daniel Pettit. He is a Coast Guard Petty Officer First Class. And he was driving to work. It was early Saturday morning, about 2:30 in the morning, actually, as he's on his way to work. And he noticed something glowing up ahead in the roadway. As he got closer, he could see that it was a vehicle on fire, a minivan, that had driven off the road and had hit a tree. Daniel Pettit, in the right place, at the right time, didn't just pick up his phone and call 911 and say, hey, there's a car on fire here. He pulled over. He got out of his vehicle. He ran to the burning vehicle. And he tried to free the driver. There were two other Good Samaritans who showed up. Together, they were able to free the man behind the wheel. Daniel Pettit then returned to the burning vehicle to look for other passengers. He didn't find any. He returned to the driver, helped administer first aid until paramedics arrived. Daniel Pettit said, when I arrived on scene, it was my duty as a Coast Guardsman and as a person to render assistance and make notifications to emergency response personnel. Nobody, he says, is a bystander to an accident when you are the first on scene. You become the first responder, he said. WIFF says the extent of the driver's injuries are not known at this time. But what we did know and what we do know is that Daniel Pettit, as well as two other individuals, putting themselves at risk for the sake of another. Daniel Pettit saying again, I couldn't just drive by. I couldn't just make a phone call and wait for the fire department to show up. Nobody is a bystander to an accident when you are the first on scene. You become the first responder. And Petty Officer First Class Daniel Pettit did a fantastic job of responding when he needed to. And we thank him for being one of the many, many good guys out there. Now, I mentioned that Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom is going to join us in just a little bit for this week's Liberty Update. Last week on the program and in recent weeks, we've talked with Tim about Justice Antonin Scalia. So I am fascinated to get Tim's take on George Mason University renaming their law school after Antonin Scalia. The Center for Individual Freedom has also launched a campaign to oppose the House Super Chapter 9 bankruptcy legislation for Puerto Rico. I didn't even realize that there was such a thing as Super Chapter 9. I guess that's just for the states, commonwealths. But we'll talk with Tim about that as well. And Tim also had a post this afternoon. This is one of those stories that is so typically Washingtonian, and it's so inside baseball that I think it makes people's eyes glaze over. For a long time, you know, campaign finance reform was one of those phrases that made people's eyes just kind of, and then it became a fight about corporate speech and had to overturn Citizens United. And then all of a sudden it's about, you know, the big guys silencing the little voices, even though it's actually kind of the opposite, but whatever. So the Federal Communications Commission has this new regulatory proposal regarding set-top boxes, the cable boxes. Tim says it simultaneously embodies crony capitalism, regulatory overreach, and technological sclerosis. Oh, great. So they have this mandate, this regulatory mandate, that they want to make the cable TV set-top boxes artificially compatible with third-party entertainment devices. As Tim wrote, in other words, even as cable companies themselves voluntarily move in the direction of abandoning traditional cable boxes and move towards devices owned and maintained by individual customers as they so choose, the FCC wants to impose 1990-style regulation on the industry that would essentially freeze in place the increasingly outdated model of set-top cable boxes, even as it becomes increasingly anachronistic on its own. Where you didn't even probably think the government had much interest in set-top boxes. No, apparently they do. In fact, you know, again, you would be surprised at what the government is interested in these days. Over at Instapundit earlier today, a story is actually from the Washington Post, I believe, about the concern over the Obama administration pushing banks to make home loans to people with weaker credit. Now, I mentioned that I watched Hateful Eight over the weekend. I rented but have not seen yet The Big Short. Hopefully I'll be able to watch that tonight. But that's about the housing bubble in 2008. One of the problems, one of the causes of the housing bubble in 2008, the subprime mortgage industry, loaning money to people who were high credit risks for home purchases, and then banks and lending institutions being on the hook when they couldn't pay their mortgages. Okay. So the Washington Post says the Obama administration is engaged in a broad push to make more home loans available to people with weaker credit. Huh. Seems like we've kind of done that before. An effort that officials say will help power the economic recovery, but that skeptics say could open the door to the risky lending that caused the housing crash in the first place. President Obama's economic advisors and outside experts say the nation's much-celebrated housing rebound is leaving too many people behind, including young people looking to buy their first homes and individuals with credit records weakened by the recession. In response, administration officials say that they are working to get banks to lend to a wider range of borrowers by taking advantage of taxpayer-backed programs, including those offered by the Federal Housing Administration, that insure home loans against default. Now, here's a key paragraph. Housing officials are urging the Justice Department to provide assurances to banks, which have become increasingly cautious, that they will not face legal or financial recriminations if they make loans to riskier borrowers who meet government standards but later default. See, the banks are saying, these people are credit risks. I'm not really sure that we want to, you know, issue a loan of $60,000, $80,000, whatever. Thousands of dollars for these folks because we're not sure that they're going to repay us the money. And the Obama administration is saying it doesn't matter if they pay you the money or not. Just go through these FHA programs, and that way, even if they default, we'll give you the money. We being the taxpayers. Officials are also encouraging lenders to use more subjective judgment in determining whether to offer a loan and are seeking to make it easier for people who owe more than their properties are worth to refinance at today's low interest rates. Yay. How about that? Now, buried in this Washington Post story, there is this this paragraph here. Deciding which borrowers get loans might seem like something that should be left up to the private market. But since the financial crisis in 2008, the government has shaped most of the housing market, insuring between 80% and 90% of all new loans. It has done so primarily through the Federal Housing Administration, which is part of the executive branch, and taxpayer-backed mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, run by an independent regulator. David Stevens, Obama's former FHA commissioner, now the chief executive of the Mortgage Bankers Association, says the financial risk of just one mistake has become so high that lenders are playing it very, very safe and many qualified borrowers are paying the price. And so the FHA, in coordination with the White House, working to develop new policies to make clear to banks that they will not lose their guarantees or face other legal action if loans that conform to the program standards later default. In other words, the last time around, we could blame the banks. Banks got greedy. Banks started giving mortgages to people who were risky investments, many of whom could not afford the mortgages that they got. The adjustable rate mortgages that a lot of people received, all of a sudden the payments started ballooning. They couldn't make those payments. What the Obama administration is saying is that, look, it's not that the idea was bad of having more people own homes. That's good. What's bad is that, there was risk involved. And ultimately, those investments turned south and went sour, and we had to bail out a lot of these institutions. We had to bail out a lot of people, provide mortgage assistance for people who otherwise would have lost their homes. What we want to do is want to alleviate that risk to the banks, to the homeowners, and we want to put that risk, again, we can't get rid of the risk, so we want to transfer that risk from the private industry, private sector, over to the government. And again, we're already, insuring 80 to 90%. Of the mortgages in this country. So what's to stop the federal government from telling these banks, go ahead and lend, no matter how risky it is, no matter how reluctant you might be to do so otherwise, because it's not really your money. It's a risk-free investment. We, the government, are telling you, make these loans. it does kind of make you think how much or how little free enterprise we actually have in our system of free enterprise these days. But we'll talk about it with Tim Lee from the Center for Individual Freedom with this week's Liberty Update coming up right after a quick timeout. Welcome on set, our friend Melissa Bachman, the host of Deadly Passion on Sportsman Channel. Melissa, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. I wish I could be there in person, but unfortunately the winter weather is not cooperating with us. So tell me, what's going on in your world? What are you working on in 2016?
Well, right now I just got started on Season 5, and I'm really excited about this season. We've been on the air for quite a while now, Season 5, but one thing that I actually brought that's brand new that I've been trying to brainstorm for several years is a new segment called Memory Chase, and that's all about trying to get more kids involved. And the reason I did it is I wanted viewers at home to have a chance to send in their kids' footage. I remember when I was little, I used to look through our Outdoor News newspaper and look for photos of other kids, and then I always want to submit mine. So it's kind of the same idea. So what I'm doing is about a minute and a half segment for those kids who get picked, and then their footage can be on TV. They get a huge prize pack, just a really good way to get more kids involved.
Oh, that's really, really cool. And again, I mean, reaching back to your own childhood, we know that, look, we know that bringing kids into the world of the outdoors is critical. And it's not just critical for the industry, it's critical for the next generation. You know, I as a father of five, I want my kids to understand that there is a world beyond the TV screen and their tablet. You know, I want them to get out and enjoy the great outdoors. And unless we actually help them, you know, I don't think they're going to do that. The TV's right there. The tablet's right there. It's so much easier to just stay on the couch, but it's so much better to actually get outside.
Absolutely. And what I'm trying to do is really bridge that gap. You do have so many kids on YouTube. You've got them online. You've got them watching the television shows. So use that medium to get them outside. So that's kind of been the idea behind it. I also know we don't have to give kids prizes for everything, but it doesn't hurt either. So a new bow, all sorts of great stuff. Plus they get to see themselves on TV. We've had a lot of submissions since it started. The first five were amazing. It's just really neat for anybody to see that real reaction from the kids. And it makes, you know, other adults excited and kind of reminds us to do our part as well to get out there and to bring kids along.
You know the threat is real. You sit in meetings with advisors and operatives who tell you there could be Islamic sleeper cells in every major American community. You know the southern border is a welcome mat for terrorists to enter our towns and neighborhoods at will. You know about their plots to kill us in our shopping malls, our sports stadiums, and our office buildings. You won your office by talking like a champion of freedom. Now it's time to act like one. Pass a national right to carry law that guarantees my constitutional right to defend myself, my family, and my fellow Americans anywhere inside our borders. And make sure the enemies of freedom know the power of freedom. No law-abiding American should be forced to face evil with empty hands. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I'm a mom, and just like millions of other women, that's why I own guns. We're responsible, we're law-abiding, and we're everything that makes America strong. Every day, we're willing to use a firearm to defend our families. But the media will never tell those stories. If a mom puts a gun to the face of a home-invading thug and makes him run for his life, the story gets buried. But if she's unarmed and murdered, the cameras will be at the scene before the police. It's time for moms like me to speak out. We are the majority. We demand the freedom to defend our families. And we challenge the media to tell the truth about our rights. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, Christian Toto of Hollywood and Toto. Coming up in just a little bit, talking about a recent episode of ABC's Quantico featuring a lecture right in the middle of the news or of the entertainment. All of a sudden, boom, anti-gun lecture. Is this start of a trend here in Hollywood? Well, I shouldn't say the start of a trend, but we'll talk about it with Christian later on in the hour. Right now, I want to welcome from the Center for Individual Freedom, our friend Tim Lee is with us. Tim, how you doing, sir?
Doing well. Happy Monday to everybody.
Happy Monday. Yes, indeed. All right. So we were just talking about the Center for Individual Freedom's website. You've got a post of the blog here. And I said this is one of those issues. Frankly, I was kind of surprised. I shouldn't be. I know the government has interest in all kinds of things, big and small. But one would think that set-top cable boxes would not be like Tim, I know that in my list of priorities for the government, cable TV set-top box devices are really, really way down the list. In fact, they're not even on the list.
Yeah, well, this is the Federal Communications Commission that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. You know, and we talk on the show a lot, and a lot of other conservative and libertarian shows discuss the overreach of the Obama administration. And by the way, we're about to get one, I think, from the Obama administration, from the Supreme Court, smacking down the Obama administration again with regard to waterways and its Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. You may have discussed it on your show, but navigable waterways and the overreach that occurs on things like that when, you know, you own a piece of farmland that isn't connected to any waterway, yet the EPA comes in and says, well, you have a pond here, and it is sort of adjacent to some properties that have some ponds that do flow over to waterways, and you know, we think we can therefore regulate it as a waterway under the EPA, under its navigable waterways authority. That's the sort of thing that we see a lot, obviously, from the Obama administration. But of all the agencies, the Department of Labor, the EPA, et cetera, I think the FCC could be the worst, the Federal Communications Commission. We've talked on this show a lot about net neutrality. And some of the things that they're doing on that. And by the way, they're before the courts as well. They've been smacked down on this twice before, and now they're back a third time, and we should be getting a decision soon. But getting back to the post that you were referencing a moment ago, with regard to the FCC, I think they may be the worst. They are blatantly political. And you need to look no further than Title II itself, where they wanted to regulate the Internet with what is called net neutrality, which isn't neutral at all. It's essentially Obamacare for the Internet. It's regulation of something that was doing fine without Obama administration regulation. But what we're looking at now, set-top boxes, and you're right that it does sound trivial that the Obama administration and the FCC would delve to this level of detail. But it frankly actually reflects some crony capitalism, which is something we also talk about on this show. Besides regulatory overreach, we've got crony capitalism here. And without getting into too much detail, essentially, you know, and I have no problem with Google as an organization, but let's face it, they exert an enormous amount of control within the Obama administration. They favored net neutrality. And they favor this set-top box proposal. What it does is essentially grants access in a way to Google that really violates a lot of people's, I think a lot of consumers' privacy. I think if people realized what would be going on here, they would be concerned. It also undermines copyright protections. And that's something we obviously value quite a bit at CFIF. But at any rate, the bottom line for all this, without getting into too much detail, and if people want to check it out, please do go to our website and we describe in detail what this set-top box proposal does in greater detail, is it essentially tries to regulate those set-top boxes in your home. So think about it right now. You know, I think most people out there have home entertainment systems where, you know, they get cable or satellite or whatnot. It's rapidly evolving. A lot of people are cutting the cord. A lot of people and cable companies themselves are moving away from set-top boxes to things that individual consumers purchase. Mm-hmm. So this is something that's naturally occurring anyway. It's part of the evolution of the marketplace. And what market in American life is more evolutionary and more constantly changing than home entertainment? I can hardly think of any. Yet the FCC comes in. And on behalf of some favored companies within the Obama administration, they come out with a set-top box proposal that that only freezes in place technology from the 1990s. It's a really, really bad idea, in case you didn't get that impression from me already. But it's something that a broad coalition also of people are opposing, and frankly, a bipartisan coalition. The reason I posted on the blog today about it is that a Democratic congresswoman and a Republican congressman created a joint letter on Friday asking the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, which is essentially the congressional watchdog and audit agency for the federal government, they asked it to investigate this set-top box proposal for the damage that it would do. So the bottom line is, it sounds trivial, but these set-top boxes that people have in their homes, mm-hmm. it's something that the FCC is trying to go in and regulate. It amounts to crony capitalism. It amounts to technological sclerosis because it kind of focuses on technology that's almost 20 years old now. And so it's a horrible proposal. But the Obama administration is trying to do this stuff and rush it through before they leave office. So please do come and check it out because it's something that you're going to be hearing a lot more about, too.
Talking again with Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom. You know, you talk about crony capitalism. You talk about regulatory sclerosis. Tim, I don't know if you've had a chance to see the story. It's in the Washington Post today about the Obama administration telling banks to Obama administration pushes banks to make home loans to people with weaker credit. Basically, what we saw in 2008, the Obama administration wants to replicate, only this time they're telling banks, hey, listen, go ahead and make these risky loans because you're not really on the hook. We're on the hook for it. We insure 80 to 90% of the home loans in this country anyway. So if anything bad happens, you're not going to be at risk. The federal government will assume the risk of these loans. Tim, this sounds like a really, really bad idea to me.
Well, we talk about this on your show fairly often as well. I think one of the main differences in my mind between the left and the right politically is the left believes that history is this sort of progression, a straight line, almost a straight line, where people evolve and learn lessons from the past and we perfect humanity. I think most people realize that's not true, that what happens is history is more like a circle and a cycle of making the same mistakes over and over and over again. This is a perfect example of it. If we haven't learned our lesson from the housing bubble and the recession that followed it, what hope is there for the federal government? And this is a real pet peeve of mine because obviously in this campaign season, you're hearing a lot more of it right now from the left. And it's this notion that the housing bubble and the recession that followed it was somehow the result of George W. Bush or Republicans. All you have to do is Google, and I, here I go referencing Google in a positive way, so I'm obviously unbiased. Go out and do a search term or on YouTube for Barney Frank and housing bubble, or Barney Frank and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. What you'll see is video of Barney Frank, one of the most liberal people in Congress in recent memory, saying, these are the words he used, I want to roll the dice a little bit more. The Republicans were actually trying to rein in some of these easy loans. The Bush administration was. And the Democrats actually were the ones saying, no, that's racist. You're redlining. You're harming people with worse credit history. They tend to be poorer and minority homebuyers. And there's merit to that argument. But what they did is say, hey, unless you want to be slapped with a lawsuit for redlining and being discriminatory, you start giving out more loans to people with poorer credit histories. And then we saw, obviously, the result of that. One other thing, by the way, when you hear about how the Republicans or free market economics was the cause of the housing bubble, ask somebody. Next time you hear them say that, just say specifically, what did George W. Bush do, or specifically, what did Republicans do that caused the housing bubble and the market crash and the recession? The only thing you'll usually hear from people on the left is that it was repeal of Glass-Steagall, which is kind of this obscure banking law. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is Glass-Steagall repeal occurred under Bill Clinton, not George W. Bush. And so they can't even identify something that Bush did except some vague notion of market economics and trickle-down economic theory. And it just doesn't add up, but that obviously won't prevent Barney Frank and Hillary Clinton from saying it. But, you know, think of that next time they tend to preen and act as though they're the enlightened ones and they're the ones bringing – talking about serious issues in this election instead of personal insults. I mean, that's juvenile stuff. It's stuff that, you know, a junior high economics student wouldn't want to put onto a paper and be graded on. Yet, you know, it's popular myth. So anyway, sorry about the rant on that. But for anybody who hears that Bush or the Republicans or market economics or free market economics somehow led to the housing bubble, just ask them to specifically name what happened. And if they say Glass-Steagall, say, well, you know that happened in the 90s under Clinton, right? And kind of watch the look on their face.
Talking again with Tim Lee from the Center for Individual Freedom. I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
You guys all have a great week. I know the weather's good. The cherry blossoms are blooming. And so happy week. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you too, sir. Enjoy some In-N-Out burgers this week, will you?
You too.
For those
or
of us
I'll
who cannot.
Next time. Sorry.
I was going to say
didn't
you
mean,
too. You cruel, cruel man. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom. Just for that, I'm going to go get the best donuts in Virginia this week. I'm going to take a picture of me eating one, send it to Tim Lee. Christian Toto of Hollywood in Toto will join us on the program in just a little bit, sort of again out of nowhere in ABC's Quantico. Comes a lecture on the need for gun control and how, you know, it's not even really a right to bear arms. It's a privilege to bear arms. Yeah, this is what happens when Hollywood decides to put the message in a very ham-fisted way front and center in your favorite television program. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company sponsored by Nosler right after this.
Speaking to our good friend John Anoni with 2 Million Bullets and Camp Compass. John, welcome back to NRA News. How are you, my friend?
I am on top of the world.
How are you? How's Allentown?
Allentown is in need of some improvement, and I guess that's why I'm there.
Amen, brother. So first, before we get in, you got some neat projects I want to talk to you about. Yeah. But tell folks, what is 2 Million Bullets and what's Camp Compass? What do you do?
2 Million Bullets is actually an orange-ribbon campaign to prioritize our children in the youth shooting sports. That as well as Camp Compass, which is a nonprofit that rewards inner-city kids with outdoor excursions, basically hunting and shooting.
How long have you been doing this?
Ooh, I've been grinding a long time, 20 years. 20 years, 22 at the camp. I've been in the classroom for another 27. So we tend to say that there is nobody walking this earth that knows kids better than I.
Yeah, I would say that's true. So let's step back for a second before we talk about your new project. How did you get into all this?
You know, it wasn't by my choice, actually. You know, sometimes this road that I'm on is a pretty lonely road because saving kids is not an easy thing, especially, you know, you might as well put devil horns on me because not only do I save them through using the gun, but I save them through killing stuff.
Wow.
Basically our critters, you know, so it's
God's
something
little
where,
creatures, yeah, John. What kind of person are you?
You know, according to my kids, a pretty darn good one, you know, it's something where, you know, I found this because of a need. And wanted to make sure that other kids who had the same need, you know, have that fulfilled.
Awesome. So what did that lead to first? What's the timeline?
You know, Camp Compass, you know, I actually started out of the back of my truck in 94. Just thought the books weren't cutting it and needed to reflect on my life to see what made a difference in my life. And, of course, it was shooting. And it was hunting non-traditionally, of course. With that... went back into the classroom to teach to try to help and just figured out that it was something that I needed to give back.
Well, I'll tell you what, John, I've been talking to a lot of people about this. What you're doing now and been doing for 20 years couldn't be more important now because there's a lot of talk about not only about hunter numbers and some people say they're going up, they're going down, but it's not just that. It's just attack on that lifestyle, on hunting, on the outdoor sports, on shooting, like from people on the other side who have really ramped up the rhetoric. Your devil horns, yeah. John, are growing bigger and bigger and bigger because they think you're so evil.
You're right. And you know what? You know what? If I could kind of counter that a little bit, you know what's starting to be a pretty neat role that's starting to happen is people on the other side are starting to come to me and say, you know what? I'm looking at this a little differently because you're saving our kids. And you know, it's something where it's hard to be the king of both mountains, but I can tell you that there are some people on the other mountain that are starting to climb up mine because they understand that our kids, their lives, are critical. and they want to see ultimately kids win just like we do. And I think we're starting to convince some people that what we do is a pretty good thing.
Awesome. All right, so let's talk about the new camp. What do you have going on? Something new.
You know what? Actually, we have a new documentary that is coming out called Camouflaging Our Differences. Pretty strong title. Mm-hmm. And I say that with excitement because I think we get a knock in the industry in regards to who the industry is, you know, who the industry is portrayed to be. And I can tell you, I walk the halls and I meet with people constantly that are of color and of non-color. And I can tell you what, the bottom line for us is kids. So that's the reason we decided to name it Camouflaging Our Differences. It may shake some people up a little bit because they might be a little uncomfortable. However, change is coming.
Sometimes, John, people need to be shaken up a little bit.
Well, and I don't do it, you know, because I get a rise out of it. I do it understood.
Yeah.
I do it because, you know, it's necessary for me to save kids' lives. And, you know, I could walk 30 kids through this hall today, and they would receive the same love that I would get, probably even more, because once again, our people want to see these kids win, not necessarily in a pro-gun agenda, but in life.
Right. All right, John Anoni, 2 Million Bullets and Camp Compass. How do we get more information about all the great things that you're doing?
You know what? You can look me up on those sites, 2 Million Bullets, 2millionbullets.com.org, or campcompass.com or .org, and you'll find me there.
John Anoni, thank you so much for what you have done and what you continue to do. And thanks for visiting us here at NRA News.
Oh, pleasure.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Coming up, we'll give you a sneak peek at tomorrow's program. Right now, I want to welcome from HollywoodInToto.com, our friend Christian Toto. How you doing, Christian?
I'm good. How are you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. Sure. I actually saw a movie this weekend, Christian, which is kind of rare for me. I did. I saw Hateful Eight, as a matter of fact.
Mm.
Kind of wanted to see how, you know, given the fact that Harvey Weinstein said he was done making violent movies and then he produced this one, I just kind of wanted to see, like, on a scale of, you know, Bambi to Reservoir Dogs, where did Hateful Eight fall? You know, Christian, It was pretty violent for someone who said he wasn't going to be making any more violent movies.
It's almost like he was telling a tall tale.
Almost, yep. And I'll never believe anybody in Hollywood again. and to that end, on ABC, so Dan Gaynor at Newsbusters let me know about this last night. ABC's Quantico had a scene in which apparently, like, while a terrorist attack is taking place or moments after a terrorist attack has occurred at the FBI Training Academy, there is a senator who's there on scene who launches into this anti-gun, anti-Second Amendment diatribe, Christian, in which she talks about almost, you know, 330 mass shootings in this country in 2015, an average of almost one per day. I'm tired of this, she says, and you should be too. You're being trained to carry a weapon, to respect the power of a gun, to understand that it is a privilege to be earned, not a right given to anyone who, and then she stops and take the rest of the day off to process and recuperate. Take the rest of the day off, FBI agents who, you know, are just subject of a terrorist attack here. I'm sure there's no work for you to be doing. You know, this strikes me as a very unrealistic scene. Not necessarily that you would have an anti-gun politician seize upon a tragedy and in the immediate moments afterwards call for some sort of gun control legislation. That part actually rings very true. What does strike me as implausible here is that it almost seems like in the midst of this action-packed sequence, got a timeout, PSA, now it's the gun control time, Christian. It just seems really heavy-handed.
This is the definition of bad storytelling, when you stop the movie cold or TV show cold and you put in your talking points. Now, there are certainly ways to get a message across without doing that, and you could agree or disagree with the message, but the bottom line is, if you're a fan of the show, if you're just watching as entertainment, you don't want to be lectured at. And that's exactly what this is. I mean, let's put aside the fact that the senator played by Marcia Cross is wrong here, mm-hmm. She's bungled the Second Amendment, obviously. It's just bad storytelling. And, you know, it's funny. I'm a big Newsbuster fan, and I read the site all the time. And they're often sort of pinging the different network shows for doing just that. And I feel like they do it, and the broadcast shows do it much more often. And I could be wrong. Maybe this is anecdotal. Than the cable shows or even the streaming shows. I mean, I watch Daredevil. I never see the show stopped cold for a PSA about the Second Amendment or anything like that. It's just storytelling.
And you know, it's interesting because, as you and I have talked about before, conservatives seem to be getting a little bit better in storytelling in terms of putting that story first, right, and not mm-hmm. being so heavy-handed about the messaging. And as you say, now we sort of see this, at least at the network level, mm-hmm. sort of the opposite happened over on the left. They are getting a little heavy-handed, and I wonder if that's because they feel like they're not being heard. You know, what does it? How many times do we have to tell you bumpkins what to think and why gun control is a good idea? I mean, we've tried being subtle. We've tried doing the celebrity PSAs. You know, what is it that we're going to have to do here for you to get through your thick skulls that this is something you should want?
It kind of reminds me of global warming alarmism, because there've been so many movies and TV shows that have hit the hammer on global warming. You know, telling us what's going to happen, the worst case scenarios. Movies like Snowpiercer, The Day After Tomorrow. And then you look at the polls, and the public just doesn't care about the issue, in part because they see the temperatures, you know, have been basically stuck for quite some time. So, you know, I agree. I think it may be a frustration on the sense of the storytellers who just feel that they're absolutely right, and they feel they've got to send their message across. And rather than doing it in an organic way, it's speech time, and that's exactly what happens.
So I am curious. There's a group in Hollywood, the EIC, right, the Entertainment Industries Council. And from what I understand, this is a group that sort of doesn't lobby politicians, but it lobbies the industry to talk about issues, including gun control. And so when I see something as heavy-handed as this, I wonder – did this come from the writer? Maybe even the writer thought, you know, organically, I want to include some sort of gun control line here. But are there resources there in Hollywood when the screenwriters or the directors, you know, they want to go in a certain direction, a political direction? Who do they reach out to? I mean, who do they say, okay, I want a fact about how many mass shootings we had in this country last year. Give me some talking points on gun control. Where do they go to get this stuff?
Well, listen, they could go online, do a quick research, and check out sort of their preferred groups and get all the data they want. You know, you mentioned the EIC. That's an interesting argument or interesting topic, because it's really hard often to kind of do a cause and effect, that a group demands that more stories tell about X or Y, and then all of a sudden you see X and Y on the latest TV shows that are on your TV set. I think it's sometimes hard to track, but, you know, it's certainly possible. And even if it's not directly involved, it could be the kind of case where a screenwriter gets whiff of this and says, hey, you know, I'm writing a show next week, talks about terrorism, talks about guns. Maybe it's my responsibility. I've got a right to do this. And then sort of the words come out after that. So it's really hard to kind of pinpoint the cause and effect. But at the same time, it's out there. It's in the conversation. It could just be someone who has a cause and wants to send a message and doesn't want to do the hard work to do it in a more satisfying way and just wants to make a speech.
So do you think we're going to see more of this, and not just related to gun control, but as we get closer through the elections? You know, I know that scripted dramas in particular, they've got a lead time at least of a couple of months before you'll see the finished episode. But are we going to have a very politics-heavy entertainment industry between now and November, you think, Christian?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just given, you know, past his prologue, I mean, you've seen the late night comics really savage people like Ted Cruz. I mean, obviously, you can't not attack Donald Trump. He brings on a lot of this stuff himself. But even I've noted on my website, I mean, Ted Cruz has been called some really nasty things in a way that isn't even remotely funny. It's just cruel. So I think from the late night field, you're going to see a lot of that. But I think on shows like this, too, listen, we know what the issues are going to be between now and Election Day. It's going to be immigration. It's going to be guns. It's going to be the economy. So I think they may not pick very specific issues, but they can kind of do a broad brush approach and say, hey, we want to get our message out. I don't think this will be the last time we'll hear something like this.
All right, Christian. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is a pleasure, as always, talking with you, and I look forward to doing this again very soon.
All righty, thanks.
Christian Toto of Hollywood in Toto joining us on the program here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Now, we are also keeping our eyes on some legislation around the country. We've told you earlier in the hour, we have until May 3rd for Governor Nathan Deal in Virginia to sign or veto the campus carry bill. If he does not take any action, then the bill does become law. The Associated Press with a story here, lawmakers and advocates digging in for Deal's decision on the gun bill. Representative Buzz Brockway, Republican from Lawrenceville, Georgia, co-sponsoring the bill, said he did not want to predict which way the governor would lean. He also said he did not think the veto of the religious exemption bill earlier this week would weigh into Deal's decision. He said, I don't think folks like retribution or revenge in politics. So if he chooses to disagree, we will just roll up our sleeves and work harder. Hopefully, again, gun owners in Georgia have rolled up their sleeves, have written an email, sent a text, made a phone call, let the governor know where they stand on campus carry. In South Carolina, the state newspaper reporting that the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee says there will be no more gun bills receiving a hearing this year. The state newspaper says the news is a blow to advocates of other legislation, including bills to expand the waiting period for background checks prior to gun sales. Senator Larry Martin says, I don't support any of that. He says, I know there's probably a handful of members who do, but this is one of those times when the prerogative of the chair has to step in and say, you know, I don't want my email system shut down or my phone lines blown up over something that has no chance of passage. He said that if he did schedule hearings on such bills, he believes out-of-state groups opposed to gun control would email his constituents labeling him as a liberal gun-grabbing chairman. He said, to be blunt about it, no, we're not taking them up. Senator Marlon Kimpson, a Charleston Democrat who has authored several gun control proposals, said the decision was, quote, unfortunate. He said, for any committee to deny a hearing on an extremely popular bill and an issue that, in my opinion, is the biggest public health issue impact in South Carolina and thus gun violence is contrary to why we are elected. Now, there are some bills that have received hearings already in the legislative session. One bill would allow retired judges, prosecutors, workers' compensation commissioners holding concealed carry permits to carry concealed anywhere in the state just as they did before they retired. Another bill would called the Second Amendment Preservation Act, which has passed the House already, would prohibit the state from enforcing any federal law, regulation, and act after January the 1st that limits the right of a person to own, possess, or use a firearm, ammunition, or firearm accessories. The third bill would recognize Georgia concealed carry licenses, which would in turn allow South Carolinians to carry concealed in Georgia. Subcommittee approved that bill unanimously. But gun control advocates unhappy in South Carolina that gun control bills are not going to get any further hearings there in the state. Again, the head of the Judiciary Committee says there's no point. They're not going anywhere. We're just going to have our phone lines melt down from people who say don't vote for something that we're not going to vote for anyway. So let's just eliminate the effort there and say, now we're not going to vote for them. So we'll continue following the progress for the bills that do remain throughout the rest of the South Carolina session. Meanwhile, in Idaho, July the 1st, Independence Day coming a little early for the state this year, that is when constitutional carry will go into effect officially in Idaho. Now, you remember, in Idaho, before the passage of this law, no permit was needed to carry a firearm in areas of the state outside of city limits. That has now changed. Now, Idaho is a permitless carry, just like Alaska, Arizona, Kansas, Maine, Vermont, West Virginia, Wyoming. There's still some dispute between the AG and legal minds in Arkansas about whether or not Arkansas is a true permitless carry state or not. It was Senate Bill 1389, signed by Governor Butch Otter, passed in the Senate by a vote of 27-8, passed in the House in Idaho by a vote of 54-15. Took 18 days for the law to take effect. And again, you had broad bipartisan support here for this measure. And there does not appear to be, based on what I've seen anyway, widespread vocal opposition to permitless carry. Yeah, don't get me wrong. The anti-gun activists, you can certainly find them quoted in the local papers. But what you don't find is, again, a lot of real grassroots opposition here. The Idaho State Journal quotes Caribou County Sheriff Mike Hatterley, says he's glad to see the law signed into law, or the bill signed into law. Says the constitutional carry law does not extend outside the state where concealed carry permits are still required. That is a very good point, by the way. Idaho's law does not have any impact outside of Idaho's borders. But this is the reason why the concealed carry process remains in place in Idaho. This doesn't get rid of Idaho's concealed carry license. For those who want to be able to carry outside of the state of Idaho, you can still get your concealed carry license. You can have reciprocity. Not everybody needs that. Not everybody wants that. And again, for a lot of folks, this is a financial consideration. You should not have to be overwhelmed with government fees in order to exercise your right of self-defense. So Senate Bill 1389, signed by Governor Butch Otter, and will go into effect on July 1st of this year. All right, that music means, unfortunately, we are almost out of time here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. Coming up on tomorrow's program, obviously, the hero of the day, deal of the day. We're talking with Bethany Bora, Jed Babin, Julie Gunlock, and more. We'll see you soon with another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.